Let me welcome everyone to today's session, where we'll be getting a briefing from Petro SA, Sanedi. Oh yes, that's two of the state-owned enterprises today. It's Petro SA and Sanedi. Welcome, honorable members. Honorable members, I think we must think of a plan. We're really getting outnumbered. Is it because we're getting too much popular? I think what we need to do is just to get apologies, and then we can do introductions. It would be just helpful for us to have a sense of who is here, who's agreed and committed to come and grace our meeting. It's only a humble meeting just to work out our plans, but as you can see, Minir, you know, we really going back to our former glory of being a popular committee. Okay, Mr. Kotze, can you help us with the...
Thank you, Chair. Just the following apologies. Honourable Tinto was attending a conference from the 18th till the 20th. Honourable Ferguson, who's attending the Portfolio Committee on Water and Environmental Affairs. Honourable Smaller, who has constituency commitments. And then Mr. Honourable Greiling, who has a prior commitment, Chair. Those are the apologies, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we start with the table first, and then get the honourable members and then the rest of us just to do very, very quick introductions. My name is Sisanji Galana. I was told to chair this committee. I hope I'm still capable of doing that, and that I'm not.
The former Portfolio Committee on Energy.
Good morning, Maya Tula is the name, member of the committee.
Good morning, I'm Nomvula Matshibela, member of this committee.
I'm Gordon Seto, Vice President for Corporate Strategy.
Nosizwe Nokwe Makamo, Group CEO for PetroSA.
My name is Benny Mukaba, I'm non-executive chairman of the board of PetroSA.
Good morning, Chair and members. Kaza Nasumba, responsible for corporate and shared services, PetroSA.
Good morning, Stefanazo, acting CFO, PetroSA. Thank you.
Chief Risk Compliance Officer.
Come again. Good here.
Kerry Larkin, Chief Risk and Compliance Officer.
A very strong position, very strategic position.
Good morning, Chair. Ever since September, Vice President for New Ventures Upstream.
John Fabre, Vice President, New Ventures Midstream.
Patoli Lezwane, Acting Vice President, Trading, Supply and Logistics.
Morning, Chair. Darren Arendse, Vice President, Human Capital, PetroSA.
Good morning, Chair. Gustav Friesel, Chief Operating Officer, PetroSA.
Thabo Mabaso, Group Communications Manager, PetroSA.
Good morning, Bonga Zungu, Government and Stakeholder Relations Manager, PetroSA.
Good morning, Mabatu Matiwane, PPE Manager.
Good morning, Sutikas Makiva, Government and Stakeholder Relations, PetroSA.
Okay, we'll talk. It's not so easy. Something wrong is going. She knows. No, never mind. It's an open secret. Okay. Let's go to the bank.
Patrick McLaughlin, monitor. Pali report, various commercial plans.
No. There's a quiet lunar gentleman right at the back. If you could use the mic.
My name is Andrew Borwick. I'm from Russian Consul General in Cape Town.
I wish I could say welcome in Russia. We feel it?
Trust Priest. Okay.
Morning. I am Duke Kleinboy, Assistant Director at the Department of Energy State-Owned Entities Oversight Department.
Morning, Harry Masinga, PLO Stroke Realizing Officer, Office of the Deputy Minister Energy.
Good morning, my name is Mohad Mudise, responsible for Clean Energy as the Chief Director of Department of Energy.
Hi, Ivan Kale from Shah, Head of Government Relations.
Muzim Kize, Chief Director of Hydrocarbons, Department of Energy.
Wendell Little, Reuters.
Well, my name is Tony Mola, MD Intense Engineering Solutions.
Iliso Dotuana, Deputy Chair, Iliso Consulting.
Right at the back, right at the back.
Okay. Unati Magira, a transformation from engine. Thank you.
Hazel Baker, Fenwick.
Mike Stead, engine.
Sir William Abota, Energy Research Parliament.
Rodkin, PwC. Ian Wiener, Gas Liquid.
Ruth Brown, PMG.
Yanni from Respec, SABC Radio.
Yodis Wala to Communications Parliament. Esther for UNASA.
Part of the furniture.
Several countries have been a consultant for dynamic energy. Trade is with the CEO of your research
association. Is the market of Standard Bank?
Natasha Dick, Staff Acting CFO.
Susan Mwango, Central Energy Fund.
Saul Jockey, Political Consulting.
Rias Jaudin, Central Energy Fund.
Raji Boko, Central Energy Fund.
For me, Lady Manito. Standard Bank.
I hope Standard Bank will pull in the other big three. I don't know why it was so popular to Standard Bank only, or attractive to Standard Bank only.
Jill October, Standard Bank.
You see? I just said it.
Sarah Henderson, Standard Bank.
Dr. Shana Lalavi, the Ambassador of Iraq to South Africa.
Ambassador, I feel so honored. The whole ambassador to be here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes. I wish I would say welcome in Arabic. All I can say is shukran. Okay.
Just say ahlan wa sahlan.
Pradeesh Rampasad, Content Advisor to the Portfolio Committee on Energy.
Ariko Kotsa, Committee Secretary for the Portfolio Committee on Energy.
Thank you very much, everybody. I know it takes time, and it's not usual that we do this lengthy introduction, but I think honorable members also, it's for us not to just take for granted, to just have a sense as to who is coming here, who has interest on the work that we do. Of course, we've got we're obliged to do our work according to constitution and the law, but at the end of the day, day-to-day activities, you know, are definitely informed and influenced by those who come here, except the other partners of Standard Bank. I hope you'll use your marketing skills to get your partners to come and listen as well. And we welcome particularly diplomats, I mean, at that level, representing their country from both Russia and Iraq. Without wasting any time, then let's hand over to Petro SA, take us through what you regard as your plans, both the strategic plan and also the operational plan. Over to you, Ndati Mukaba, and Snopsis.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman Susan Jigela.
and the members of the Species Committee, which is charged with the oversight on energy matters. Members of the Fourth Estate, thanks for the time to brief you. Chairperson, my name is Benny Mukava. I'm non-executive chairman of the Board of PetroSA, which is the accounting authority responsible for PetroSA. And with me in a different hat is my fellow board member, Susan Jagelan, Susan Mwango, as well as Nosizwe Nokomakamo, who is the group chief executive. Chairperson, we're making this presentation in the context of various changes in the world of energy, especially in the oil industry and gas industry. We are fully aware of this context on the commercial and social and political environment. Let me start that it is perhaps in this room or a room nearby that gentlemen and perhaps ladies early in 1920-odd set to chart what was to be the white paper on the synthetic fuels of the industry of South Africa. They, irrespective of their party alliance, as members of the Union of South Africa, put aside and cast aside the differences to create a white paper that was to be the basis of that energy sector. It was later in the 1950s that the committee set again to create what was to be a cutting-edge company called Sucor as well as Sasol. Companies that were started by initiative of the policymakers of the government of South Africa. We are a national oil company created to a large extent by decisions of the state. We exist and grow to meet the objectives of the state and of the people of South Africa. It is not surprising that after the First World War, the Minister of War of Her Majesty the Queen of England was charged with establishment of an entity that could provide security of supply for Her Majesty's fleet in the potential war. A man called Winston Spencer Churchill created a company which was later to be named British Petroleum, a national oil company charged with a responsibility similar to ours to ensure the security of supply of Britain. Similarly, in another country, another era, around the 1980s, China charged two companies with the responsibility to ensure the security of supply, one Sinuk and the other Sinopec, with the utmost responsibilities of finding resources to secure the security of supply of the country and to participate in the oil industry. These two form the basis of models of which we can see over and above what you see in Petrobras and in Malaysia, other national oil companies similar to ours. However, their path, similar to ours and different from us, has required the full support of their national governments as well as their people. Similarly, they were charged with doing their job in the context of friendly and hostile presence, not very different from our own. We, as directors of the board of this company, are faced with what Senator Moynihan of the United States would have called maximum feasible dilemma of telling as much as we can to comply with the rules of Parliament, and Chairman also to comply with the responsibility in terms of a PFMA, but similarly, on the contrary, charged with fiduciary responsibility to not expose to our competitors who come from elsewhere information that might be commercially sensitive and might jeopardize the very interests of the national company you're trying to build. So we will ride that thin edge of telling you as much as we can while protecting the interest of your national entity. It is not surprising that in this room present are our competitors of different forms and our customers of different forms. So some commercially sensitive matters, we might say, we'll tell in broad terms. And Chairman, please protect us and protect the interest of the company and the interest of the country. The world today is charged with various changes. You know that the acreage in South Africa are pretty much taken, and the scramble for Africa for resources, for gas and oil, is at its peak. It is in that context that we seek to create a national oil company very different from what CNOOC and Sinopec and British Petroleum faced when they emerged. Our challenges are enormous. We're sitting in target areas for investments as well for resource acquisition by others. So we have to do a strategy going forward. In this context, Chairman, we will be presenting as frankly and honestly as possible what we have tried to do. It is not the first time we do so. It is a continuation of the creations of a national oil company that all of us can be proud of. I will ask the group CEO, to present to you, but let me highlight what the chairman of Sinopec said to me 2-3 weeks ago when we signed an agreement on Mtombo. In his view, their success to becoming the third or fourth largest oil company in the world, starting from 1980s to today, was largely because they found solace in the unified effort of their people, their country's people, to the creation of that company. And they were able to build that massive effort, not only by resources, by what decisions were made, but also by the attitude of the parliamentarians and the people of their country. Chairperson, is a mammoth task that the CEO and her team are tasked with, and the board, and we humbly submit to you the presentation to the board. They say Gaspedia cannot translate it. I cannot translate it, Chairperson, but it simply says we do it in the open. We plan and execute in the open, while others have the pleasure of having confidence of their strategies hidden behind bars. Thank you, Chairman.
Chair, may I proceed? Thank you. Thank you, Chair of the Board. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, honorary members. We are aware, as has been mentioned earlier, of the immense challenges that face South Africa. The low growth rates, poverty, unemployment, inequality, the need for a greener economy, the need to improve to energy security, the health challenges, the need for infrastructure. And we are aware that the government's adoption of the National Development Plan is driven by the need to address these challenges and to build a capable state. As South Africa's national oil company, we've developed a corporate plan 2013-2017 that supports government policy, including the National Development Plan. In the National Development Plan, Chair, it states that in the short term, we must do exploratory drilling for economically recoverable shale gas reserves. We should develop offshore gas. We should promote the investment in LNG landing infrastructure, introduction of clean fuels in the country. And for all those, Chair, in our plans, PetroSA plans, we've addressed those in the plan that I shall be presenting. In the medium term, the LNG infrastructure will be in place to power the first closed-cycle CCGTs, combined-cycle gas turbines, and a decision will be made on whether RSA would continue with imports or to invest in a new refinery. Chair, in the plan, I will deliberate on how we are going as PetroSA to respond to that mandate. And our mandate, Chair, and our plans are also aligned to the shareholder, wherein the strategic intent of SEF is to provide energy resources for national energy security, minimizing environmental impact in pursuit of government policies, And our Department of Energy mandate is to ensure secure and sustainable provision of energy for socio-economic development. Our Vision 2020 Chair focuses on sustainability, security of supply, as well as transformation. As Petra say, our Vision 2020 is geared in that manner, and we will share what are the steps and the building blocks that we have towards the attainment of that vision. Before I go into the plan, Chair, please allow me a few words on the progress since our last presentation to the committee. In general, we have continued to operate safely and profitably in spite of very challenging conditions. And of course, the committee is aware that we have been operating with declining indigenous feedstocks and rising feedstock costs. Our refinery in Mossel Bay has remained our key focus area. We mentioned last year that we were about to embark on Project Ikwezi, which is the quest for more indigenous gas around the shores of South Africa. And I'm pleased to report to this committee chair that the Ikwezi offshore gas project is progressing well. Drilling started, and we expect first gas in the second half of 2013. The only challenge, Chair, is that the weak rand increases our rand capital costs and the cost of imported items. Further changes since our last presentation to the portfolio, Chair. As mentioned earlier, we've embarked already on the project studies, feasibility. We have completed our pre-feasibility study on Project Mtombo, which is our refinery project. It continues to gather momentum because we have signed a framework agreement with Sinopec on the 27th of March of this year, where we are going to now embark on our feasibility phase. The other good thing, Chair, is that the project is recognized among the SIP 3 projects of the strategic infrastructure projects of the country. Our LNG project, Chair, is also progressing. We have begun our EIA process, and our application to the Department of Environmental Affairs has been accepted with regards to the EIA application. Last year, Chair, we also spoke about an acquisition we were busy making in Ghana, in the prolific fields off the shores of Ghana, which is Ceiba. That has been finalized. What that has done, Chair, is that it has added oil reserves and has created a new revenue stream. As the committee is aware, we had a revenue stream only from our refinery, and due to the fact that the indigenous feedstock was depleting, it was imperative that we come up with different revenue streams for the sustainability of the company. So we have, as I said, added new revenue streams, which is the Ceiba acquisition. We are intent on finding more projects such as these, and we continue to work on that. From a transformation perspective, Chair, we have built and handed over our first integrated energy center in Mbizana, which is in the Eastern Cape. The energy center, Chair, offers different services. It has a energy center, a convenience store, and it also has a training center. It's got also a fuels forecourt. And I must say, Chair, it was a proud moment, as Petra say, when we were able to hand over the Mbizana energy center to the cooperative from Mbizana, from the community who run the energy center. We've trained the cooperative, and we continue to have a training center that offers training facilities for different energy-related disciplines. Chair, I've talked about the issue that we are operating in a very tough environment. We're facing increasing challenges into the future, but we know how to address them, and maybe I'll just touch on some of the issues. The declining feedstock we're addressing with Project Ikwezi. We know that we operate in an environment where we have increased competition for the hydrocarbon assets. And I think what's important, Chair, to note here is that internationally and also locally, the access to hydrocarbons is becoming more expensive due to the fact that the deep water access is more expensive than if you have to access your hydrocarbons on land. So that's one of the challenges that the oil industry is facing, and we are also facing those same challenges. Of course, we are also competing with companies that have been in existence for many more years than we have, who have greater resources than we have. But it's not a problem because we have mechanisms in which we are trying to address some of these risks. The chair will also know that the oil markets continue to remain very volatile, and as Petra say, we are not exempt, or we are not operating in a vacuum. All those impacts and all those variables have a direct impact on Petra say and our risk profile. We are, Chair, working on mechanisms and methods to mitigate those risks, and we have put strategies in place to be able to respond such that we're able to deliver on the mandate that we have. Chair, I think what is exciting is that as a company, we are now getting into full project execution, where we are moving the company from where it used to be as a single source income generator to where we want it to be. And as a result, Chair, the going forward into 2013-14, we're going to see pressure on our financial results due to the fact that we are in full project execution mode. With those introductory words, Chair, if you allow me, I'll go straight into the strategic plan. In brief, Chair, our proposed plan does advance our shareholder security of supply objectives. It does strengthen our role, as Petra say, as a sustainable national oil company. I've mentioned that we are operating in a tough capital-intensive environment, and therefore our plan is also tough capital-intensive and is going to be subject to a lot of external and internal risks. We will reduce profitability over the next few years. We'll go into a trough, Chair.
Intentionally.
Chair, due to all the conditions that I have explained in terms of the declining feedstock, which leads to your declining revenue generation, and also the cash that we had on hand, Chair, we're going to be now using that cash, Chair, to build projects that are going to build this company into, as I said, a more sustainable company with more impetus and impact on our socio-economic development trajectory. So in a way, Chair, it is intentional because it's better than having cash just sitting in the bank and not working. We are now going to make that cash work and put it into projects that are going to grow the company. Chair. Chair, for us to be able to do this over the next few years, we do require very strong partnerships, of course, shareholder support, an enabling regulatory environment, good governance, and a very resourced and capacitated organization. And as I mentioned, Chair, we will need support from all arms of the country, including the committee. The plan, Chair, advances...
Please, don't look at me only. They are the other members. Also, you are on the firing line when it comes to that.
Thank you, Chair. The plan advances Petrosa's sustainability and growth strategy. As I said, Muscle Bay is very important to sustain our refinery there because that sustains jobs in the area. A lot of the economy around Muscle Bay is very dependent on the sustainability of the Muscle Bay plant. Our plan also develops and beneficiates our hydrocarbon resources. We want to diversify Petro-SA's income, create longer-term revenue flows. We want to add new refining capacity and cleaner fuels. We want to create our presence in the downstream arena. We want to create an LNG import facility for GTL and power generation. The plan promotes addition of gas, Chair, to the energy mix in the country. It moves us towards a greener economy. It does promote transformation, helping us to advance social equity and organizational capacity. Chair, very briefly, this is our Vision 2020, and I mentioned that these are all the projects that we'll undertake towards there. We've got Ikwezi, which is current, our LNG, which we're working on as well. We're looking at our entry into downstream logistics and tanking. And, of course, further down the line, Chair, we envisage that this national oil company will play a key role in the development of shale gas in the country and, of course, additional refinery capacity in the name of Project Chair? Ntombo.
Excuse me, Chair. We're not using the same Bible here. Our document is not reflecting what is on the screen.
Oh.
Just for letting you to that, Chair. You can have to question the answer, though you don't have
one. Which one should you? Do you have, bro? I was a bit behind myself.
Oh, I was going fast. Might it be?
Hmm?
I think it's just, is it this slide curve that's missing? I'm told here by my...
That's
oh, yeah, the one, this one. Two slides which are missing. Apologies, it's just this, this slide, the printing error, I think. It's just this slide and the one before. Apologies, Che. I'm told here by my colleague that this is the one that's missing.
Okay, then it would be helpful if you could share it
yes.
electronically
okay.
so that if you don't have to reprint, but at least if you could send to all of us electronically. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for that. This, Chair, maybe I should just then mention that this slide refers to our Vision 2020 and the building blocks that we've put in place in our strategy towards that Vision 2020. It shows that we're operating currently from 2012 up to 2013 and 2015 on our current indigenous gas. And then it shows how Project Ikwezi comes into the picture and ramps up our production. And then we also show how the LNG, or alternative feedstock that we're looking at, is going to take us to a full capacity in the GTL plant. So that's about sustainability of the GTL plant. Then we also talk about the growth elements, which are the downstream logistics entry, which is the green part. And then we talk about how the Ntombo refinery comes in and when our entry into the shale gas development also comes into our building blocks beyond 2020. That's really what the slide illustrates. Thank you, Godwin. To go back to current, the Ikwezi, as I said, the drilling is progressing. In the plan, we intend to drill 5 wells. The drilling campaign duration will take between 2 to 3 years. The project is has created at least about 1,600 jobs, which number we want to audit using our audit methodology. For the creation of jobs, it has created 1,600 temporary jobs. What this will do is that it will extend the production at the plant. Once we get the gas, it's going to extend the production at the plant to 2018-19. And currently, the project is going to cost about $1.2 billion. Chair, we're very pleased with this because it's one of the first campaigns of its nature off the South African coast in quite a long time. In terms of growth, Chair, on the upstream perspective, I spoke about our Ghana acquisition, Ceiba, currently producing about 110,000 barrels a day. And we're looking at further development opportunities to increase production. In EG, Chair, we continue with our farm out strategy where we are de-risking our portfolio, and we're de-risking so that, as you know, our area, the industry of upstream, is extremely capital intensive, so we need to de-risk the assets, and we're going to look at minimizing our risk, and we continue with that going forward. In terms of the Venezuela project, Chair, that we spoke about as well last time, we're looking at how we can fund this exploration, and we're hoping that this leads to an acquisition somewhere around about 2016. In our plan, we've captured it as such. The three circles, Chair, are just showing us in terms of the Ghanaian project in Deepwater Tano, in Jubilee and the West Cape 3 points, and it's talking about how we have the other shareholders and the other partners that we have that we're working with in those areas. Chair, detail on Project Mtombo, we're making progress, as I said. We finalized some of the work in terms of the business case development. In terms of the equity partner issue, we're now working together with ourselves. We haven't reached that point in terms of the decision on the equity partner, but we are working with the PetroSA, with IDC and Sinopec in terms of the feasibility study going forward. And then, of course, we have the framework agreement with Sinopec. In terms of infrastructure development around the project, we are participating in SIP 3, and that is important so that we can align infrastructure requirements with the stakeholders, which is the Kuka Development Corporation, Transnet, and Eskom. We are also participating in the CDC-led IDZ Infrastructure Development Network. With regards to funding, Chair, at this point, the Industrial Development Corporation is participating with us in the feasibility study. And as Chair knows, post the feasibility study, that is when we'll have more certainty in terms of all the elements which went into the pre-feasibility study. And after the feasibility study, we'll go into FEED and then we'll go into the final investment decision. So we're quite a way away in terms of that, Chair.
Just on that, what is CDC and what does SIP 3 cover? Remember,
sorry?
We've got 18 SIPs, so it's so difficult to... What does the SIP 3, what areas does it cover, and what is CDC?
I've got it on the next slide, Chair.
Okay.
The CDC is the Kuka Development Corporation. And maybe just to go into SIP 3, it covers the southeastern node and corridor development. It's supposed to promote rural development through new dam at Umzimvubu with irrigation systems and so on, and also on the Wild Coast Highway, which improves access into KZN and national supply chains, and it's supposed to strengthen economic development in PE through a manganese rail capacity from Northern Cape, a manganese center and smelter, and possible Mtombo refinery in Kuka, and transshipment hub at Muha, and rail upgrades to improve industrial capacity and performance of the automotive sector. So, just ready to verbatim. So that's what the SIP 3 covers, Chair. So what it means is that there are critical infrastructure development stakeholders, which is, as I said, Transnet, the Kuka Development Corporation, Eskom, the province, and the municipality. So we have ongoing engagement and reporting to the SIP coordinators. And Chair, I think that is one of the milestones that we've achieved since we were last year with the committee. Chair, one of our strategic thrusts as well is transformation. And what we've done since we last reported here to the committee is that we have, in terms of enterprise and supplier development, we now have a plan that increases focus on the development of small BEE businesses. Of course, we're going to build on the muscle-based supplier development experience, and we think that our Vision 2020 initiatives, all of them, including Project Mtombo, do create new opportunities that we did not have before, where we operated only as our refinery and were able to have impact on economic development only because of that single source income. Now with all the other projects that we are working on, we believe that this is going to create new opportunities. And if we take that into practical, if we draw practically from practical experience, Chair, we can draw practical experience, for example, from some of the experiences that were done at Mozal. That was a case study, a world case study, in terms of how such infrastructure, when it was put on the ground in an area where that type of infrastructure did not exist at all, how the enterprise development happened. That has become a case study, and we are hoping that we are going to be able to replicate those type of experiences. From an employment equity perspective, Chair, we'll continue in the plan to promote equal opportunity in all occupational categories and levels of the workplace. And of course, we are doing partnerships with universities, which will help to develop the talent pipeline, because we've identified, Chair, that the issue of employment equity, because everybody is involved in it, the pool from which everybody is drawing is the same pool. And therefore, it is important that we develop talent pipelines little bit earlier than when people now start to hit the workplace, so that we can draw those from those talent pipelines, especially because our area of work, Chair, is unique in the country. There is only really one or two companies in South Africa that are South African that are busy with things like upstream, and we are the only company in that area. So it is important to develop those different talent pipelines. From socioeconomic development, Chair, we'll continue to do social upliftment through targeted investment programs and create meaningful economic empowerment benefits through our preferential procurement policies. We do have, Chair, our Synthetic Fuels Innovation Center at the University of Western Cape. We will continue in this period to work with them, and we are going to increase the technological work that we are involved with them at the University of the Western Cape. Chair, I mentioned earlier, as a result of all these projects that we are embarking on to grow the company and to sustain the company, we foresee that our profitability profile in the planning period is going to remain under pressure. Chair, they say that you cannot make money without spending money. So our approach in this is that we are going to have to spend the capital that we have so that we can be able to go over out of the trough and go into a more profitable arena and also become a national oil company of standing in South Africa. One of the things that we have identified, Chair, talking about operational issues, is that if we're embarking on this trajectory of growth and on this trajectory where we are busy with very important projects, we have put measures in place so that we can have effective project management. We're using, obviously, a project execution model in terms of making sure that we show good project governance. We're using expert international project reviewers so that we can make sure that we are benchmarked and our project readiness is able to be at par. We have a strong PetroSA owners team with engineers, project managers, contract managers, and project controls with all relevant experience for the execution of mega projects. And of course, Chair, in terms of our legal services and procurement, we want to make sure that we've got strong governance around the procurement and contract management using different contract types. And, of course, the policy and procedures aligned to PetroSA governance. We have put in measures, Chair, in terms of internal ways of improving the governance. We've got very tight governance systems in place where we've got assurance committees and we've got compliance managers, and you did mention earlier, Chair, that the group risk officer is a very strategic position. His area, Chair, is extremely busy at this moment in terms of how to make sure that all the risks in terms of all the projects are adequately addressed, identified, and mitigants put into place. So they have actually been extremely busy and will be busier going forward.
That's an assurance for Standard Bank. An extra billion for PetroSA.
Chair, just maybe a little briefly, that we are using a combined assurance framework and approach in terms of the systems. We've got major risks covered by, you know, different lines of defense. I guess this is mostly what is a practice. We're not reinventing the wheel here, but we are implementing all the best practice mechanisms in terms of managing our governance systems for our projects going forward. I think what's important, Chair, as we embark on this journey, of course we need to make sure that we, from a human capital system, we make sure that we are also aligned, and we make sure that we are organized in the right way. So we've got 6 focus areas in our human capital system, which is the transformation, continuous business improvement. As we've got a changing business, it's imperative that we make sure that we've got continuous business improvement in place. Cost optimization, due to the fact that, as I've mentioned earlier, we are engaged in transformation, but at the same time we have to make sure we keep sustainable, and we are faced with the challenges that we face, so continued cost optimization is being managed from there. Talent management, I've mentioned that. Leadership and skills development, and of course culture and values, and consolidating and strengthening our infrastructure from a human resource perspective. Thank you. In conclusion, Chair, the 2013-2017 corporate plan supports both the government's development agenda and our sustainability and growth imperatives. As I said, from a sustainability perspective, we will continue to focus on our on continued production in the most efficient and optimal manner at our gas-to-liquid plant. We, Project Ikwezi, will start production in the second half of 2013, inshallah. The LNG project targets first imports by 2017, and they will have increased focus on cost control and efficiency improvements. From the growth perspective, Chair, Project Mtombo, we will complete the feasibility study in 2014, and of course we continue with targeted pursuit of upstream opportunities which are de-risked, and we have put in place good governance, project execution and human capital management systems in the company so that we are able to confront these challenges in the most optimal way. Chair, we are aware that we're operating in a very tough environment, and we will continue to operate in a tough environment. But Chair, because we have the will and because we need to, we at PetroSA are ready for this challenge. Thank you.
Chairman, before you go to the question, may I remind this committee that there was an outstanding issue from our last presentation. With all this effort, which we also included in our annual report, the governance matters that was also initiated, an audit review initiated by the minister, that is underway. The board is set with several state projects and reports in different statuses, and when it is fully ready, it will be brought here by the right entity, either the minister or the board. I thought I put that because it was a decision of this committee at that time, but we'll come back to this committee, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mukawa. Thanks very much for that. Honourable members, it's our time for questions, clarity, thinking, and comments. Madam Lot.
Chairperson, just some few minor questions, Chairperson. The CEO of PetroSA did indicate in one of the slides, I think it's slide 12, and emphasizing the almost underlying the type of support that's required by PetroSA to be able to conduct their business and ensure profitability. One of the areas that was mentioned is the shareholder support and the enabling regulatory environment. My question, Chairperson, is to PetroSA, can they be able to share with us the nature of the support that they would require from the shareholder? And secondly, when it comes to the enabling regulatory environment, what regulatory measures are seen to be or are perceived to be impediment towards the profitability of PetroSA, put the other way around, what regulatory environment do they want to see in place to to ensure that it assists to assist the profitability of PetroSA. The other question, Chairperson, I think it has been said before in this committee that 2020 becomes almost like a crunch time for us in terms of security of supply of petroleum finished products, because it's said that we'll be importing at least in excess of 25% by 2020 of finished products. Now, the critical question that I want to pose to PetroSA is whether the timing around Project Mtombo is precise. Are we not going to foresee problems if Project Mtombo is not brought on stream timeously? And how long would Project Mtombo take before we realize this crunch time in 2020? I think the last question, Chairperson, would be, it's on, I think, should be slide, I can't see the slide, sorry. But it's around profitability profile in the planning period. From this slide, it's quite clear that downstream activities are going to be quite crucial for the profitability of PetroSA. Now, again, what type of support do you require from the state? And have you allocated enough internal capacity in terms of human resources, also even funding, to ensure that this element does not escape your attention and focus? And also, after acquiring, and I don't want you to go into details of what you're acquiring, because it might be commercially sensitive information, but in broad terms, are you comfortable that the culture that's within PetroSA would be aligned to whatever acquisition that you make, whether it's downstream, midstream? Would they be aligned to the culture of the institution that you are acquiring? The concern is one. I'll tell you why I'm raising this question. You know, and I'm not, you shouldn't take my views to be harsh and highly critical of PetroSA, but in general, you find SOEs have got a different culture. And you go into the private sector, you find, you know, a culture that focuses on the bottom line. But SOEs, you know, from my limited engagement with SOEs, some of them have got this attitude that they would always go to the shoulder, you know, with a bowl asking for money and thinking that the shoulder must always inject capital. I mean, I don't have to go through examples. We all know the examples that we are facing. So I'm talking about the issue of culture. Is it something that you really, as the CEO and the board, pay particular attention to it when you acquire these companies, so that we shouldn't, I'm not saying you have got a wrong culture, but be critical of yourself so that we shouldn't infuse into these entities a culture which might, I'm not saying you have a wrong culture, and I need to emphasize, a culture that's not pro bottom line, you know, a culture that, and I don't want to mention this entity, we all know them, you know, and bring a wrong culture within the entities that you are acquiring. That's just my. I wanted to pose certain questions, but after your statement about commercial sensitive information, I wouldn't pose them, but I can pose them in general terms. You know. Yesterday we looked at the financial statement of CEF, and you look at the level of inventory. You know, I don't want to go into details about it, but I just want to find out, are you comfortable with the level of inventories from your side, or you think you need to be reducing them and not just tie up cash in inventories, you know, in huge inventories? I mean, I'm just asking broadly. I think that's for now.
That's.
Can you take Mamatibela, bro? Or not for now? Okay. From my side, just a few specific and direct questions. I do applaud the fact that you had the first integrated energy center. I've driven past it whilst it was under construction. I wish I could have an excuse to go down that site once again to see it when it's finished. Also, one needs to applaud the fact you have added a few other additional facilities, which is a trend and patent that we have observed that comes up you know, in these integrated energy centers, and hope that will even improve as they proliferate in future. Two questions around it. Has the cooperative been trade that has been established? Because in terms of risk and also history, that has been the challenge with the previous integrated energy centers. And to what extent is the municipality of Mbizana itself looking into or cooperating and engaging with the IEC such that it becomes more than a success? I think as we've been moving along, monitoring and observing the rollout of IEC's, the role of municipalities has also been an issue that is becoming more and more under spotlight. Can also, if you can, I'm quite attracted to the reference that whilst creating an LNG import facility, you also would like to contribute to power generation. Is it possible that you can elaborate on that? Because it ties up very nicely once again with the reference you make below that you want to promote addition of gas to energy mix, which I'm sure that strengthens the department's strive for adequate and sustainable supply of energy. Regarding employment equity, you want to build partnerships with universities to develop talent, which is fine, but shouldn't you also look into FETs as well? When we engage with FETs as well as the Department of Higher Education and Training, which is one of the areas that we emphasize that may need focus as well. As we all know that our government is beginning to invest more and more on further colleges for further education and training. I think in future it would be helpful one way or another to share to us how the international experts expect international project reviewers through the independent project analysis organization. What's their take on the work that we're doing? But it's at this stage in time, it's highly commended that you offer yourselves and you subject yourself to that scrutiny, not just internally within the country, but even internationally, because then it means as you move along, you'll move with confidence, you know, in dealing with things. So in a sense, if you could from time to time share with us, you know, in future, that would be very helpful. It would really put us at ease as well. Okay, over to you for now.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the questions. Maybe, Chair, if I can start off by saying one of the great things about working at PetroSA is that we work as a team. So if you'll allow me, Chair, I'm going to distribute the questions to the people that are actually running with those different things so that they can give the adequate and apt responses to those questions. Maybe just to state, Chair, that one of the issues, one of the questions was about the issue of what type of regulatory environment support that we're talking about. And I guess if we look at globally, Chair, looking across the globe and looking at countries, especially, let's say, hydrocarbon-producing countries, you look at their regulatory regimes and you find that those regulatory regimes are skewed towards increasing local participation and local content in terms of the in terms of the access to the hydrocarbons. And if they've got like national oil companies or local companies in place, those regulations are usually favored towards making sure that the NOC is a partner in terms of the exploratory area. So those are some of the things that we look at in terms of, we are currently in the throes of engaging with our act so that we are participating. There was a public participation process and we participated in that and made our recommendations. From a shareholder perspective, clearly it is support for the vision that we have, and also where we see barriers in terms of some of the barriers or barriers of entry into different or certain areas, just to get the requisite support from the shareholder. So in there, the answer is more broader from that perspective. But we do engage as well with our shareholder in terms of some of the things that we need assistance from. The enabling regulatory environment I've already spoken about. From a country perspective, really, it is the notion that support for the notion that in order to have a direct impact on the industry from a socio-economic perspective, it is important that we do have a national oil company of standing. And that would be generally from support from the country, as it were, from the different facets and authorities in the country. To talk about the issue of culture. To date, Chair, the PetroSA, even though it is a state-owned entity, has been operating in an independent manner, i.e. from a funding perspective. We have been generating resources from our gas to liquid plant, which resources we are now pumping into the projects so that we can take the company onto the next growth trajectory. So we have not yet come cap in hand, as it were, up to this point.
Please don't come in the shoot.
We have a shareholder, Chair, who I think we have been engaging in, and we are going to come up with different mechanisms, innovative mechanisms, that are going to be able to assist us to deliver on our projects in our growth trajectory. Sometimes, Chair, the support that we talk about is not overt in terms of, you know, must it be tangible, but that support that says, as I think the chairman, when he began, said, that acceptance that we need to have a national oil company of worth, and therefore, what are the things that we need to do collectively to get there? And that's the type of support that we really are talking about. Of course, the onus is on us to actually demonstrate and prove why it is that we require this type of issue. So it's not just we understand that we need to put effort to demonstrate the reasons why we require that type of support. And with those opening words, Chair, I think There was also a question on the downstream activities, whether we've allocated enough to ensure that this element does not escape you. Chair, we are seized every day. That is one of the most important projects that we have, and we are working towards that. And have we allocated enough? We think that we are putting as much as we possibly can into that effort. I would like to actually ask if my chairman, because this would be a very strategic issue, if my chairman could deal with the issue of the Mthombo, the Mthombo refinery, the downstream, the crunch time that you talked about of 2020. And then I will also ask Mr. Arenze. He's going to deal with the issue of the FETs and the universities and how we can work better with the FETs. The Mbizana, Makolile is going to go into detail on the Mbizana and how we are actually working with the community there. And then the International Expert Project Review is going to be dealt with by Mr. Falbe. And the issue of inventory is going to be dealt with by Mr. Fanazo, our CFO. Thank you.
Thanks, CEO. I think if my chairman gave an indication that in other places, when government create national oil companies of strength, to be of the caliber of the BPs of this world, the Sinopecs of this world, what they do with their legislation such as MPREA is to ensure that the stakes of the state are allocated to those national oil companies. It is a precise decision that creates that amount of wealth and retains a certain specific portion of value created for the national interest and to ensure that the value of the country is created. Similarly, the RASs of this world and the PPAA. Those acts, componently, certain clauses are allocated to ensure that there is a section allocated to the national oil company. We are not a resource-poor country. And I'm sure going forward, even if we look at our shores and our reserves, there is an opportunity for us to create that entity that will in future play a dominant role in our economy and the global economy. It is possible. So it's a matter of what do we do about it. Just as this country created the Sasols of the soil that dominate that area, we can create companies that do the same. Chairperson, the matter of the timing of refinery coming in stream is a function of projected growth rate of demand of fuels. We have come to this committee in the past and presented different models based on different scenarios of economic growth as to when a certain volumes will be required. It is true. Let's fung it and says fungibly around the area of the year 2020 and year 25, there will be a high demand for a refinery of the size of what we're projecting or what could be projected, anything between 250 to 350,000 barrels per day, depending on what the growth rate is going to be. So based on that, Mthombo has to come in somewhere between that era, between the year 2018 and 2024, there has to be additional refinery capacity. That is ipso facto, or ceteris paribus, all things being equal, that no other refinery shuts down and no other refinery gets a hiccup and that others do not fail to meet the specs that's required. If anyone kills over, then your period within which you're going to demand additional refining capacity goes higher. But I do want to reemphasize, the net economic effect of building your own refinery, it is, should not be taken lightly. The economic return to the country are much higher than what sometimes people give them advantage to. Just all you have to do is create an economic model that shut all refinery capacity in South Africa and see what the effect is on, number one, your exchange rate if you have to import all finished products, your tax base, looking at your revenue side,
as well as your current account. The effect is just unbelievable. So it's a no-brainer that a refinery in South Africa is required. The timing is how fast can we do it, and we believe that it has to be between the period 2018, 2022, 2025. That it has to be operational by that time. Otherwise, you're going to see, with this exchange rate, a direct effect on your economy at a level that you had not imagined before. We are here as part and parcel of a family of energy, team energy. We are an entity at the implementing level of a shareholder being SEF, and we are aligned, as the CEO said, with what the minister said. When the ministry presented their projected security of supply on Tuesday, Jefferson, you'd have seen the coherence from the top on policy level and the role that projects such as Mthombo will play in national security of supply. I'll stop there, Jefferson. I thank you.
Chair, committee. On project management, I think it's very important to know that we know what we don't know. And that's quite important, because if you know what you don't know, you know what gap you have to fill here. And we have been through this project planning process together with international experts who really we use for benchmarking of the project as such to really ensure that this project of this magnitude can be managed. We have reviewed our whole project structure accordingly, and we use here mainly in the beginning IPA, International Project Benchmarking Company, which we also used in Shell when I was in Shell before I joined PetroSA, so we use the same benchmarking company. So in essence, they have a very good structure to say globally mega projects which are defined as changing the environment in which you operate or which are beyond your capacity of the organization who's running a project has to follow a certain structure, otherwise you fail. And a lot of projects globally fail because of things which doesn't belong really to the project but which are outside the project. So therefore, it's very important that you get some planning certainty in these projects, so you don't drive projects of this magnitude to become schedule-driven. That's why I think the 2020 project time is important to keep in mind, but you can't stick to this at all costs, because then you create already a project which is schedule-driven. So you need to have some flexibility without losing focus. Which is also important that in the partner integration, which we did with Sinopec in the next project phase, we did everything which you do in these benchmarking exercises to make a project of this type of success, because most projects fail because you avoid or you don't do proper partner integration in projects. So you struggle during the project phases with internal fights about what the partner wants and what the partner doesn't want and so on. So that was very important in this first phase. The second phase, which is also important in projects of nature, is to develop integrated owners teams so that you can manage projects of this magnitude. So we are in this next phase integrating IDC into the project, which is another partner into the project, to manage integrated owners teams. And we also have to align shareholder interests here. The next step is also very important to agree on the project execution strategy when you move forward. Our specialty is to operate plants. We are not experts in running mega projects. So if you know that you're not expert in this, you partner with someone like Sinopec, who has done multiple extra mega projects, who has done multiple refinery projects, who has a very strong access to the global procurement market so you can manage costs properly, and who can also bring expertise in this and challenge your own expertise. So in this phase, we learned a lot from Sinopec. We also brought our own experiences from previous studies into this project, so we are quite equal partners, but we also got some insights from their way of doing things. And they do things sometimes smarter, intelligent, and they have other ideas to do that. So I think we have a very strong partnership here where we bring the local expertise in. We bring our expertise in from our previous studies, and they bring their expertise in. So I think it's a good way of moving forward, and forming a strong team is important. When you look at mega projects failure, they also very often fail because there is no alignment with the shareholder and with the government in which the country in which you do the projects of this nature in the country. So in previous studies, we had some challenges there, but I think now with this Presidential Infrastructure Coordination Committee, we have a very strong forum where government has put a structure in place to coordinate projects of different type. So like this FIP 3 is very important to de-risk the project of this nature, because we have a platform where we can escalate projects, problems, which we find here in our interfaces. For example, the port must be aligned. So without a port alignment, there is no project. So you can build a refinery, but if without a port, you can't link it to the market. So this is one important thing, and we are working with Transnet on the integration of logistics, which is beyond this. Only if you can show a potential investor like Sinopec that you can coordinate all these logistics infrastructures, someone is convinced that this project is really going ahead and it's a chance. So we are the interface to Sinopec in this phase to produce, to position this project to the market. And we did all the estimates from outside, challenge from international project companies. I think we looked at other companies, which I don't want to name here, but I mean, we have had a lot of several project management capacity companies who benchmarked us, who told us how to do that, and the rest will then follow into the project execution strategy, which will be aligned with global best practices. Thank you.
Chair, the question with regards to the Mbizana IEC, I am able to confirm that it is not possible for a company like ourselves or any other to build a sustainable IEC without the support of the local stakeholders in the form of the cooperative, the municipality as well, and also without trained staff members and trained members of the cooperative. So, Chair, I'm able to confirm that the employees of the cooperative in Mbizana were offered training at PetroSA's cost expense in Johannesburg, as were members of the cooperative whose responsibility would be to function as a board of trustees. With regards to the degree of cooperation, Chair, to which you referred, that the members of the board of trustees and the cooperative have received from the municipality, again, I'm in a position to confirm that there has been cooperation from the municipal mayor and from the municipality. But regrettably, there has been instability on the ground, which is, I think, in the public domain. The kind of stability that should ideally have obtained within the cooperative itself is not at the level where it should be. So there is a challenge, and also the changes at the municipal level have been a challenge. So we would be grateful. We continue to work with the municipality. Colleagues were in Mbizana last week for a meeting with the new leadership of the municipality and the new municipal mayor, and we'll continue to work with them, but we'll be grateful for any additional support that would ensure that the municipality and the municipal mayor work closely with the cooperative, and in fact that whatever differences may exist at the level of the cooperative are resolved so that the IEC continues to be viable and sustainable going forward.
In response to the question related to partnerships and transformation, I just wanted to bring the committee's attention to the fact that we recognize that, already have recognized this as part of our talent and growth strategy. It will be included. We have started looking at ways in which we can integrate EPTs into our learning and development approach. More recently, EXCO gave me a mandate to look at the expansion of the Center of Excellence in particular. And that's one way in which we foresee FETs also being brought into the fold. But typically, we're also looking at issues like internships, et cetera, and how we can then close that gap between FETs and university and technologies and universities, in bringing what I certainly believe is potentially a whole lost generation of students who are out there who are not gaining access to the market. And I think they're in larger concern, and we share that concern. So we certainly look into that as part and including that in our learning and development approach.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of inventory management, we do keep a big eye on the levels of inventory in the company. I guess the steep rise that the member sees in the numbers is courtesy of the acquisition downstream, and that's why the numbers are going up. But we do keep a very cautious view on how to manage those levels. Thank you.
Member Tue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mine is on accelerated development programs. My question is, you're saying for women at level 3 and 4. I just wanted to know how many women have you already have already graduated in this course? And also, have you included people living with disabilities? The other one is the drilling time that you have put for yourself, 2 to 3 years. What happens if 3 years goes past and you haven't completed the drilling? The last one is about shakers, where because people of the Karoo were complaining about terminating of water, the water level. Is it going to be safe for the water, or what's going to happen to that? Thank you, Chair.
If I may respond to the question, my accelerated development program. The program is currently underway. We have a leadership development program, which 30 women out of the total of 91 employees that are on the program, these were women that we had identified that are currently on the program, and that program will be completed in the course of this year. We also have graduates who have also completed at least 12 of them, the Sapir Leadership Development Program, which is also accelerated development program. And we're endeavoring to, through our study assistance programs and our bursaries, to ensure that there's sufficient female representation on those programs. And our numbers, as I said, they certainly look, in respect of our bursary programs as well, in the order of 50% of the intake.
Chair, on the issue of drilling, we've budgeted for each well to take about 6 months, because the wells take two. Let's say first we have a vertical vertical well, and then we go horizontal about 1.5 kilometers subsea at a depth of about 4,000 meters. So as a result of this, the wells take a bit long to drill. What we do is we have different technologies that we can employ, either to speed up the drilling. And one of the main issues that we have when we're drilling these complex wells is for the rig to keep on working, that it doesn't stop. So our focus then is on all the activities that impact on the non-productive time of the rig. So we are confident that the 6 months that we've allocated to each well, currently the way we've designed it, currently the way we've been performing to date, we should be able to meet that. If we don't complete the wells in 6 months at a time, then we'll have a serious challenge, and we would then have to eat into our contingencies that we've set aside for dealing with that kind of eventuality.
Say on the issue of shale gas and the possibility of contamination of water aquifers, there will be a need to ensure that adequate studies and investigations, geological, hydrological investigations, are actually carried out to really identify even the locations of the aquifers relative to where the gas is. Also to identify the best methods of ensuring that contamination does not take place. Experiences elsewhere, including in the United States, are that there exist methods which, if we adopt when we explore for or exploit this natural resource, they should be confidence that there shouldn't be any contamination whatsoever. But it's important for us to really find out what the structure of the Karoo is.
Done. It's just at the time for tea. Well,
excuse me, Chairperson.
Yes.
I got the answer of the women, but people living with disability was left.
With apologies, Chair, I was about to ask if I could respond to that because I recognized and answer the Honourable Member fully. With people with disabilities, we have challenges in that respect, but what we have done is taken a more targeted approach where we've then targeted and partnered with an institution. We've identified students living with disabilities, current on programs, who will be brought into our organization, obviously progress through the ranks. So there's a memorandum of understanding between ourselves typically and is Cape University of the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. We also strengthen our efforts to employ, and we're partnering with providers who are specialists in this particular area, so we can also achieve our target in respect of people living with disabilities. Thank you.
And on the other hand, Sambula, one time last year, I think we did arrange it. There was a joint meeting with other portfolio committees. I remember particularly the one that deals with women, disabled people, and that committee. And there was a commitment that they will work with the Department of Energy to look into those areas, and that is both women and the disabled. We haven't had an update up to now. I definitely would encourage the department to ensure that it robustly engages with the state-owned enterprises as well, you know, to ensure that it shares that information to enhance these areas, obviously, Disability Alliance and the Disabled People of South Africa is another resource to tap to ensure that area. I always use the model of the Department of Trade and Industry, where they set up a these telephone facilities in Soweto. It's call centers, and it's mainly, you know, populated by disabled people. And it was a very, very good, model to show that when any department or any component of government, you know, generates the will, they are able to do something in that area. But I think from what we have observed in Petro SA's work, you are in a good footing to actually enhance what you have already done. That we take into account. In conclusion, how I wish we would have had more time, probably when in future we engage, we would like to emphasize a couple of things. You know, SMME development is crucial. It's part of, it's like downstream, because SMEs and cooperatives in particular have the capacity to help in job creation. And I'm talking with Benice in the context of the funds that you have. You know, please take a bolder step. You know, we would like to see state-owned enterprises and state-owned companies to take bolder steps in certain areas, because you have all the backing from the government, which wants to see job creation multiplied, you know, not just tenfold but hundredfold. Hopefully in future we will share with us how you plan to enhance your trading capacity, Mamuzwane, because we are under pressure in terms of getting, crude from outside at times. The Iranian saga, if I'm to be blunt, honorable members, is a very good example. I think China and India did make a very, very strong stand under the unwarranted pressure, because we do not have any axe to grind with Iran as a country. We are an assertive enough country if we need to criticize Iran on our own. I know it's a bit sensitive area, but sometimes state-owned enterprises are there to ensure that they advance the country's foreign policy, one way or another. So we would like to see you planning more robustly around the trading capacity.
I'm glad, Comrade Lotto, you raised your cultural differences. It's very, very important, and I hope at some stage the presidential review project on SOEs and FDIs will reinforce that. Hopefully it will come within this year so that we can all tap from it. Lastly, you know what, when observing, I think to me it's both a strength and a challenge for PetroSA to come and account publicly. And let's manage that exercise even more robustly in the future, honourable members. It's a strength because you're subjecting yourselves to representatives of your shareholders. As Baba Nyanzumba once said, that the ultimate shareholder of PetroSA is the citizen of South Africa, not even the government itself. It's just a legislative arrangement that the government is a shareholder. And we're here to ensure that. And we hope, even through media, that kind of interaction will be responsibly and appropriately articulated so that from time to time we can tap responses from the public as to how do they feel about the plans, the performance of PetroSA. Of course, the challenge is that you are operating in a highly competitive area, a very tough environment, unavoidably. But still, let's hold hands together, even in future. As for now, can we conclude by saying that, honored members, PetroSA has aptly articulated its plans, both for the next annual or financial year, and also right into the future and up to 2017-18. So we'll be monitoring performance on that basis. Thank you very much, would be nice to you and your team. For now, can you take a break for tea, and also can then the committee secretary prepare for the next presentation, Sanity. Thank you.
Oh, okay. you hide you away from me? Then I'm safe.
We will push for that one, yes. right?
Yes, exactly. So that's what we'll do. So do you think we must put it on? Put it on, man. We can always... What is it? Rather say to be confirmed.
No, that's the one I want. Oh, no, that's the one that I want.
Okay.
Hey, hey, how
are you, man?
How are you?
Excited to see you, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was scared that I wouldn't get to the office. So I just got to the restaurant and then
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you start settling, please?
Challenges that we have, the interim actions which we are busy with, and the baseline funding which is sustaining us up to date. I'll deal with the, just briefly with our vision. We, as an organization, have to serve as a catalyst for sustainable energy innovation, transformation and technology diffusion in support of South Africa's sustainable development that benefits our nation. And our mission is to advance innovation of clean energy solutions and rational energy use that effectively supports South Africa's national energy objectives and the transition towards a sustainable, low-carbon energy future. Our values, as adopted by the board, is to be innovative, to be accountable, transparent, deal with everything with integrity, professionalism, and but to feel it. And all what we're doing should be in the national interest. The parameters within which we are operating, that is our legislative mandate, is the ministerial directive which established NERE, or National Energy Efficiency Agency, which it was then. Then it is incorporated now into SANED, because as you know, we used to SANED. SANED was established through the White Paper on Energy Policy, which was established in 1998, approved by the cabinet then. And SANED's mandate is derived from the authority and obligation set out in the following policies, legislation, and constitutional requirements. Our Constitution, the National Energy Act, the specific plans and directives which come from time to time from the minister, reinforcing SANED's responsibilities. The strategic plan of the Department of Energy, which gets reviewed every year. The National Energy Efficiency Strategy, which was adopted in 2008. The Energy Security Master Plan for Liquid Fuels, which was established in 2007 by the department. The Energy Security Master Plan, approved by the department in 2007, and the Integrated Resource Plan for Energy, which has recently been approved in 2010. There's also a DST, which is the Department of Science and Technology 10-Year Innovation Plan, which also informs the parameters in which we operate. MNV Guideline for Employment Equity Certificates, and Carbon Capture, Energy Efficiency Certificates, and Carbon Capture and Storage Roadmap. That makes up the legislative mandate which within which we operate. May I then hand over to the CEO to take us.
Thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Chair, the members of the Portfolio Committee, Excellency, members of the media and public, as well as our shareholder, the Department of Energy. I think picking up on what the Chair has just alluded to, in the sense that as an entity, we have a very specific mandate in the energy sector, and that is actually to foster and support a transition to a low-carbon future. Now, to do that, there are certain strategic outcomes and programs that have to be put in place, and these are already in existence. In fact, from a strategic planning perspective, the vision and mission have not changed in the past. This is why we can reflect on them as being the same. What is important is that we have targeted three main strategic outcomes. The first one is really critical to decision-making at the highest level in the country, and that is to make sure that we have well-informed and high-confidence energy planning. To do that, you need access to data. That is first and foremost. Once you have access to data, you can then look at having access to the appropriate planning tools to allow the decision-makers in government to able to effectively produce and implement policies and strategies. Your second strategic outcome really talks to supporting and accelerated transformation to a less energy and carbon intensive framework. And this is obviously critical in light of what we anticipate South Africa's contribution would be to a low carbon future, where the President has already alluded to the contribution that South Africa is willing to make in as far as our CO2 emission reduction is concerned. This is all encapsulated into our climate change response white paper as well. At the same time, we also need to move the country to a less energy intensive framework. I think given the current debacle in the media regarding Eskom's contract with BHP Billiton, it puts it into perspective. Not only should we be looking at less energy-intensive industries, but at the same time to look at better pricing regimes as well. Lastly, and perhaps as important as the other three, is the need to foster this culture of a rationalization around energy and natural resources. And one thing in particular of the conservation of energy as well as energy efficiency, in which we use far less units of energy to produce the same units of output. Now, these are the key pillars, if you like, the strategic outcomes on which Cenergi's strategic plan and annual plan is based, annual performance plan. If one then looks at the programs that have been derived from these strategic outcomes, the first one is looking at our governance and looking at compliance. This is our corporate governance and administration program. And encapsulates also the overhead administration regarding the management of Cenergi. The second one is really the heart, the nuts and bolts of Cenergi's operation, and it talks to the applied energy research and demonstration portfolios, and this is where all the work that Cenergi does is actually contained. That includes our advanced fossil fuel work, which includes carbon capture and storage. It also includes the work that will be done around fracking, and as we note that fracking came up in the preceding presentation with PetroSA. It's something that Cenergi has also been tasked to look at, and we can share that with the portfolio committee in the course of this presentation. It also includes a roadmap around coal, to look at the sustainable use of coal in the future, as well as sustainable use of gas. On the clean energy solution side, we have our center record, which is the Renewable Energy Center of Research and Development, that looks at coordinating R&D as it's undertaken at our tertiary institutions, as well as with various other international research bodies and private sector R&D institutions. And that really looks at producing tangible solutions, training of human capital in the area of renewable energy. On the front of smart grids, there's a comprehensive program which we'll talk about later, which really pulls together the work of ESCOM and the major metropolitan areas in terms of producing a vision for what constitutes a smart grid in South Africa, what are the gaps in our knowledge as far as smart grids are concerned, and what is practically possible in the next few years with respect to introducing smarter grids into our environment. Bear in mind, we have this ambitious renewable energy program under the REIPP, and in order for us to inject large quantities of renewable energy into the grid, we need to make sure that the grid is able to adopt and accommodate power which fluctuates. And this is obviously the case in solar and wind in particular. On the green transport front, we're in the process of remodeling the center. The center has been in existence for the past 4 years. We've now relocated to the CSR, and we'll talk a bit later about what the green transport program involves. On the Working for Energy side, which is one of our key programs because it's one of the only programs that talks to sustainable energy provision into low-income and rural areas, while at the same time looking at the sustainable use of the energy as a means to actually create job opportunities. So putting energy and jobs together is really the key focus around Working for Energy, and we believe it's one of the only programs led by government that actually deals effectively with this need. The last one looks at data and knowledge management and talks back to the first strategic outcome, which is about enabling high-level decision-making with confidence, because ultimately you need to make sure that we have institutional memory, both within government and the private sector, that we also need to have access to appropriate and robust data. I think it's going to come down to robust data ultimately, because we have to have faith in the data that is produced and used in our modeling tools. The last program is on energy efficiency, and it really talks to cross-cutting areas. For us, it's an interesting area because there's a lot of work that's being done in other sectors, and one of our last slides talks to the need for us to be able to coordinate better across the different state entities that are currently involved in energy efficiency, because there's a plethora of activities out there, and you can think of 49M in particular. There's also cities that are running their own campaigns. ESCOM runs its own campaigns. The Department of Energy runs its own GCIS. There's a whole number of institutions that are involved in raising awareness and implementing energy efficiency programs, so we need to make sure that we can consolidate it and make sure that it's properly coordinated. So I've really spoken in some detail about the strategic outcomes in terms of Goal 1, which was the well-informed and high-confidence energy planning, decision-making, and policy development. Ultimately, as I've said to you, it's really about making sure that we have access to robust data. We need to have access to a series of databases that really talks to what is happening in terms of both consumption as well as in supply of electricity and other energy carriers. I think there's been a lot of data that's been provided for the electricity sector, but perhaps less and less for end users around liquid fuels, gas, and coal directly. So for us, it's becoming more and more important that we start shaping the way the energy landscape can be managed in terms of access to appropriate data. On the front of the accelerated transformation to the less energy and carbon intensive economy, obviously the main consideration has got to be jobs, but it has to be sustainable jobs. How do you create sustainable jobs in a sector where there is some confusion and uncertainty about the role of the state in terms of driving the long-term infrastructure development plans? And I'm thinking in particular around electricity, where one needs to consider that even with the expected influx of renewable energy projects, there seems to be very little scope for the long-term sustainable job creation opportunities. We're very clear, if you're going to pursue an agenda that includes renewable energy, where are those jobs going to come from? If you're going to pursue a nuclear agenda, where are those jobs going to come from? If you're going to establish a refinery, what happens downstream? We are creating more and more jobs in that process. So this is really what that strategic outcome talks to. The last one, really, as I said to you, about fostering this culture of greater efficiency and more rational use of energy, really homes in on energy efficiency, both electricity as well as other energy carriers, but also other natural resources. So one thing is water management in particular as being very synergistic in terms of its relationship with energy. So one has to be equally aware of the need to conserve energy as well as the need to conserve water. Now, if one considers the innovation value chain from conceptualization, so think of somebody that conceives an idea, well, I can do something more efficiently or I can do something smarter. At that particular point in the value chain, there are many instruments that are available to the individual to take the idea forward. Currently, the space is dominated and filled by the Department of Science and Technology, who plays that role. In particular, the Technology Innovation Agency has a mandate to support the development of homegrown innovation. At the same time, once we've reached the point where we have a product that's on the table that we're ready to demonstrate, this is really the point at which Cenergy steps into it and starts to support the development of a demonstration or pilot project and takes that product right through to commercialization. Obviously, we don't have the financial resources to take a product through into the market space, and this is why there has to be a close working relationship with entities such as the IDC, CEF, DBSA, and others who can afford to bankroll the introduction of new technology as it's ready for commercialization. But certainly, Cenergy's role in innovation value chain has to be to mitigate the technology and the financial risk that is attributed to new technology. And earlier the chairperson referred in our vision to technology diffusion. And I think it's critical that one appreciates what technology diffusion means. If you consider the price of photovoltaic panels, about 10 years ago you might have been paying $4 or $5 per watt at peak for a PV panel. Today you're spending just under $1 a watt at peak. So the cost has come down dramatically. For us, the important thing is how do we bring down the associated cost of technologies. Not so much interest in the end use in this particular case, because the end use is up to the market to determine. What you need to do is overcome the other barriers that prohibit the entry of that particular product into the marketplace. Think of products like ethanol gel. For some time it was mooted as an alternative to paraffin. Unfortunately, it was not as efficient and not as cheap and widely distributed as paraffin. That is one area where if the government believes that we should be pursuing an agenda which involves a solution which involves ethanol gel, then one has to consider breaking down all those barriers to the entry for ethanol gel into the marketplace. So then if one considers the basic pillars on which the Cenergy's model is based, it's obviously those three strategic outcomes. One very important aspect to consider is that as an entity, we operate in two defined spaces, one as technology developers and the other as program developers. Now, on the technology development side, we manage a series of resources that are located at research bodies like CSIR or universities. We think in particular of our energy efficiency hub, which is located at the University of Pretoria, where we've produced well over 100 graduates already, masters and PhD students that are now able to go out and work in the energy efficiency space. At the same time, we have other programs that run, as I've mentioned, the CSIR before, but there are various other centers that have been established around the country that all talk to building up the proficiency and skills of the academics and students to actually deliver high-quality research at the end of the day. On the program development side, we rely on in-house skills, on Cenergy's complement of in-house capacity. our skill, our strength lies in our ability and experience in the areas that we cover, and we have to a large degree the industry leaders at our disposal inside of Zenedi to be able to effectively manage the programs that we operate and support. The enablers that allow us to be able to undertake these activities include responsible talent management. This is looking both internally as well as the possibility of internship, which is a program that we actively support, and then also being able to empower our universities to become more advanced and in some cases to take some of the historically disadvantaged institutions and bring them up to the requisite grade as well. Also, cross-cutting is secure knowledge management. As I mentioned earlier, institutional memory is key. You need data, you need institutional memory. There are many examples of where institutional memory has been lost. Not enough time to go into them today, but certainly we've learned some valuable lessons about how to improve and to actually protect on the knowledge management side. And lastly, proactive stakeholder engagement. I mentioned the case of energy efficiency where there's a plethora of activity from different sides. Obviously, it becomes important as you commercialize products that we start looking at integrating efforts with the right appropriate entities. In fact, even an entity such as Nexa has been working with us very proactively on the biomass side, which is completely different from their conventional business operations, but certainly for them is a keen interest in working with us in the biomass space. Now, Chair, with your permission, I'm going to take you through some of the programs that we're currently operating, which are obviously of national interest. I'll also talk to you about the timelines and the associated challenges, but more particularly about what to expect in the course of the coming year. So the next few slides are dedicated to the programs that we manage, but very specifically talk to deliverables for the 2013-14 year. Now, on the CCS side, carbon capture and storage, we have a center called South African Center for Carbon Capture and Storage. It is housed within Zenedi, and most of the R&D capacity for CCS is also housed within Zenedi. We have core parties that are responsible for the management and the funding of the center, which includes SASL, the Norwegian Embassy, and ESCOM, but we also have other industry partners. And I would hasten to add that these are probably the most important in the context of the future use of CCS as a tool to mitigate against the emission of carbon dioxide. So we feel that this center encapsulates all of the main players, and so far they've all bought into the vision of where we're going. What is important is the funding allocation, and Treasury has seen fit to increase the allocation of funding to carbon capture and storage. They've made available $69 million for this year, and then for the following year, $103 million. This tapers off to $35 million in the last year, mainly because at that point we should be ready with our commercial partners for the pilot injection phase. Now that's the next phase of this program, to identify a suitable site which is onshore. We'll talk about that in a minute, but ideally that site will then house tens of thousands of tons of CO2. Obviously, there's a large program that goes with that, which includes stakeholder engagement, because as one can understand, there will be sensitivities from the public with respect to having carbon dioxide injected underground. So one has to be very sensitive. Just as much interest as we've had from fracking, there will be interest in issues around long-term CO2 storage. Then we're also in the process of trying to access additional funding through a particular fund which has been set up under the World Bank, which is supported by the UK government. The UK government has been a direct funder of this centre. They have now changed their approach. They've rationalised their ODA support, and we're now in the process of working with them on a different funding route to ensure that they continue support. The Norwegian government continues to support the centre financially, as well as the South African industry partners that I've alluded to earlier. So our activities for this year are concentrated in two main areas. One, which is the appointment of the appropriate human resources to support the pilot injection phase, starting off with an international advisory body that will be put in place this year. Also, the appropriate engineering, procurement, and construction contractors, as well as the appropriate stakeholder engagement officers. And those engagement officers have already been appointed, and they will be operating in two main areas. The areas where the Zululand and Aldoa basins are located, because those are the two prime destinations for the storage sites. For us, the biggest issue then would be once we've identified specific sites within the Zululand and Aldoa basins, is to go in and do the exploration plan, and aligned to that would be the appropriate seismic exploration work that goes hand in hand with site selection. So ultimately, by the end of this year, we'll have a good feel for which of the sites in the Zululand and Algoa basins will be suitable for the pilot injection phase. Also of interest is the fact that we need to source carbon dioxide, which is surprising given that everybody believes there's so much CO2 coming from Sasol and Eskoms, which is true, but the problem is to be able to transport them down to the appropriate site. So we've gone for an onshore storage solution because an offshore one will be simply prohibitively expensive at this stage. And also because in the case of Eskom, which has got about 13% of carbon dioxide inside of its flue gas, you'd have to separate out the CO2 first from the other flue gases. Whereas with Sasol, it's about 95% pure CO2, but unfortunately we'd have to transport the CO2 down to the coastline. So therein lies a small dilemma which the engineering team will resolve during the course of this year as well. Now on to working for energy, and this is, as I mentioned to you earlier, is one of the critical programs that needs to be sustained. I'm of the opinion that we've turned the corner in the sense that working for energy can and must continue. This despite the fact that there is no funding allocation for this financial year, and I'll mention it in a while again. One of the key things is the development of solutions that involves renewable energies and also at the same time energy efficiency. Now think of low income housing, think of building materials that are energy efficient. Those can be manufactured domestically and must be and will be manufactured, and they also contribute to job creation. So both energy efficiency and the supply of renewable energy create opportunities for growth and jobs inside of the microeconomies as well. Very important for us is to consider that we're not only providing energy, but that we actually need to provide an end use for that energy so that people are able to tap into that and become economically active as well. The typical areas that we would concentrate on would be on biomass production, looking at supporting businesses developed using energy that's derived from biomass. There are lots of waste streams that can and should be converted into energy. And in fact, one of our pilot projects is in KwaMashu, where we're busy looking at the conversion of sewage to electricity. Once the plant is commissioned, it will produce about 2 megawatts of electricity from sewage, and that will be in conjunction with invasive vegetation that will be used for coal firing. So that plant will be commissioned once the city of Itikwini have agreed to the public-public partnership that will form the basis of the relationship between Zanedi and ourselves. Already there's been a lot of background work that's been done. The fluidized bed reactor has been put in on site already, so all we need is the power generation equipment and the feedstock for coal firing. So all looks set for a very good project under Working for Energy. But think even at the domestic level, think of how much energy is wasted. Even if one considers some of the rural areas where they still make use of septic tanks, for instance, and there's a wasted resource sitting right there, we need to consider how we can introduce smaller scale digesters. And this is, in fact, the focus of some of the projects in Bela Bela and in the north and other parts of the northwest, parts of Limpopo, as well as the Western Cape, where we are introducing biogas digesters. We're teaching the community how to build digesters. We're teaching them how to use the gas effectively. We're sourcing the gas currently from cow manure as well as from pig waste. So there's quite a bit of work that's already been done in that area. Along the way, there's a lot that can be done on solar. We participated together with a French company, Soitec, which is represented here today, on the development of a 500 kilowatt concentrated PV system in Hazelmere in KZN. We're responsible for developing a training program, so we've actually been able to produce artisans out of that program that are able to now effectively install and maintain such types of systems. There's also an agribusiness that's been set up on the same facility. So it's a very important development in that it's one of the first of its kind in the country, and we're very proud that Working for Energy is associated with that. Along the way, there are other opportunities that we will be tapping into. Invasive vegetation is the key. This is sourced through the Working for Water program under the Department of Environmental Affairs, and there are projects in the Eastern Cape, in particular Uitenhage, where we'll be converting invasive vegetation to electricity using gasification technology. So quite a few programs that are underdeveloped, under Working for Energy, and during the course of this year we'll be able to show where there's sustainable job creation opportunities. Under Smart Grids, as I've mentioned to you earlier, it is important, given the timing of the injection of renewable energies into the grid, that we are able to introduce smarter grids to not only absorb that power, but also to give consumers the ability to choose.
choose suppliers and also to be able to understand and influence their own consumption as well. So this is really the basis for the Smart Grid Vision. An initiative called SASG has already been established. SASG is the South African Smart Grid Initiative. It brings together the municipalities, the ESCOM distribution businesses, the service providers, the associations that represent those service providers, all coming together to help define what that vision looks like, to understand what the technology requirements are based on the gaps that are identified under the Smart Grid Vision, and then to proceed with the development of a business case. And under that business case, there will be an implementation plan that seeks to roll out smart grids over a defined time frame. Of interest to note is that the Department of Energy, together with European funders, have put together a program for smart meter implementation in the country. The smart meter pilot project will commence this year. It looks to implement about 10 to 15,000 smart meters in a metropolitan area. It might be two metropolitan areas. It just depends on the department. They will be doing the site selection, the pilot site selection, in the course of the coming weeks or months. So very important to note how that will pan out, because once again, it's important for there to be an education and awareness campaign rolling out with smart meters so that the consumers are aware of what the meters present in terms of opportunity and how they can be linked to other things, for instance, e-learning. It might be a very useful tool to support the development of our young learners by introducing e-learning together with the smart metering technology interface that will be worked on as well. Now, on the data knowledge management side, I have alluded to earlier how important data management is. One of the key things to consider here is where that data resides. So together with the Department of Energy and ourselves and the Department of Science and Technology, we've worked towards the establishment of CESA, which is our Center for Energy Systems Analysis and Research. It is currently housed within Seneti, but involves the collaboration between ourselves and the University of Cape Town, ERC, the University of Pretoria, and the aforementioned government departments. And what we're trying to achieve with CESA, and we've already achieved some notable success in this area, is to start producing all the databases that are going to be required for planning purposes, test and develop new planning tools, particularly for use for IRP, IAPs, and then also to produce the human capital in terms of having the modeling skills, the statisticians and the mathematicians that are going to be involved on a day-to-day basis with assisting us on the planning side. So all of that is really managed under the CESA framework, and this is why the departments are so actively involved, because they see the benefit from a policy framework perspective as well. Now, to green transport, and as I've mentioned earlier, we've relocated the center from Midrand, where it was located for the past 4 years, now to the CSIR. So we're in the process of setting up a collaborative partnership for this year with the CSIR to support what we term an incubation or soft start facility. And this will really allow for industry to benefit from our R&D exposure as well as possible funding support to set in place infrastructure that will support a transition to alternative fuels. Now, in the past, we've worked with Gauteng Province, we've worked with the taxi industry in converting vehicles to run on a combination of LPG and petrol, as well as CNG and petrol. So there have been notable successes already, and in fact, we've had buses now running on CNG in Gauteng, and we put in place the refueling infrastructure for that. So that will hopefully be rolled out to other areas where we can actually source CNG. We've actually supported the development of portable pods that are used for refueling CNG, and those pods then become a form of mobile refueling facility, and that's then available to different parts of the country where we currently don't have a ready-made mainstream supply of gas into those areas. On the electric vehicle side, working together with Nelson Mandela Metro University and TIA, we have now just recently established the e-mobility facility, which will then also see collaboration with CSIR and ourselves in developing solutions for the electric vehicle market. There are a number of commercial players that are already developing electric vehicle technology, so our goal is not to be able to duplicate that. If we look at the experience with the Optimal Energy Joule, we know that this isn't the right time for us to be competing with the established motor manufacturers to develop our own electric vehicle. Rather, we should be supporting the market in as far as retrofits are concerned. There are many opportunities in public transport, in large hauling facilities, where we can actually convert those vehicles to run on electric far more efficiently than they could run on diesel or petrol on their own. So definitely a lot of opportunities around green transport, and during the course of this year we'll be able to support a number of industries make the transition in terms of their businesses being geared towards introduction of LPG, CNG and electric vehicle technology. On to the renewable energy space, and one of the key areas that we're working with governments is on the establishment of RECORD, which is our renewable energy center. It was launched last year. It's a collaborative effort between ourselves and the universities. It's supported by international governments, including Germany and the UK, the Danish government, as well as the Norwegian government. And really what we're doing is we're putting together all the research capacity in the country that's focused on renewable energy. So the type of products and projects that we're working on get the necessary support from the top researchers in the country. And they can also benefit from the IEA. We represent South Africa on the International Energy Agency's implementing agreements as relating to renewable energy. So we bring that international exposure across to the domestic partners where they're able to use that information. For instance, Ocean Energy Systems is a good example. We're actually able to support the development of local wave energy conversion to technologies using the exposure we get from the Ocean Energy Systems implementing agreement. There are some key projects that we're involved in that link up to RECORD. One of them is called WASA, the Wind Atlas of South Africa. We just launched last year to the Deputy Minister the first phase of the Wind Atlas. It's supported by the Danish government, implemented together with ourselves, the South African Weather Services, the universities of Stellenbosch and UCT, and the CSIR. And so this Wind Atlas represents the best effort so far to be able to accurately map out the wind resource in the country. The next phase in this project has already commenced, which looks at meso and micro scaling, which then takes it down to literally a 1 square kilometer level. We'll be able to tell you accurately what's happening. We'll also be able to look at weather prediction tools to be able to forecast wind speeds more effectively. That becomes a powerful tool supporting the development of more wind parks in the future. On the solar park side, as we know, the Department of Energy is working towards the establishment of a solar park, still probably a 5 gigawatt solar park in the Northern Cape. Most likely the area that's going to be used will be the Prieska area. Our role is to support CEF in terms of their efforts to develop the solar park and to undertake their feasibility study. We're looking at establishing a test and emit station inside of the solar park that will not only allow for data collection, but will also allow for the testing and demonstration of new technology that will support the developers in actually optimizing their own facilities. So a lot of our work is contingent upon the solar park going ahead. Obviously, there are still some questions with respect to how it fits into the renewable energy IPP program, but that will become clearer during the course of the year. And as I mentioned to you lastly, on the international collaboration side, we work closely with international research bodies, most notably with the International Energy Agency, where the bulk of international research is actually being consolidated. On the energy efficiency side, there is a need for us later on in the course of this presentation to dwell very briefly on where some of the key challenges are with respect to our implementation of energy efficiency. But in respect of current activities, we are currently involved with National Treasury and the Department of Trade and Industry in supporting the Income Tax Amendment Act, in particular Section 12I and the pending 12L regulations, which talk to incentives for energy efficiency in industry and the broader consumer sector out there. Already we've been actively involved in certification of projects that have come through. Our biggest contribution in that respect will also be to the measurement and verification program, which is ultra critical. For you to get the benefit of the tax incentive, you had to have had your baseline measured. You will also periodically every year have to have the actual savings verified by an MND practitioner. So for us, and this is the last point on the slide, we need to make sure that there's an MND center that is appropriately skilled and developed. There are currently only about 3 or 4 major role players, all of them academics, and we'd like to see that skills base to be broadened enough to allow access to other parties as well. We're currently setting up our energy efficiency demand and demand-side research center based on the work that's been done at the University of Pretoria. We currently fund a hub for energy efficiency at the University of Pretoria, and it's one of the success stories in the energy sector in that the professor that we've appointed to run our center, Professor Shah, has been instrumental in the production of well over 100 graduates masters and postgraduate students in the energy efficiency space. They are absolutely prolific when it comes to publishing and R&D in the space of energy efficiency, and we like to reward that by actually building up this facility into a proper center where we can actually channel more funding into it and actually produce better products at the end of the day. We provide industry support, currently fulfilling also a national champion role as per the request of the Minister and Deputy Minister of Energy, and at the same time, as I said to you, in the process of establishing this national MNV centre. So along the way, there are obviously some challenges, and every year that I've had the pleasure of sitting before this committee, I have gone on about funding. Respectfully, this year, the tone is slightly different, in that we've been pleased that National Treasury has seen fit to increase the funding allocations appropriately in some areas, but in other areas we still have a funding shortfall that we'll talk about then briefly. With funding comes the need to implement, and with the implementation plan comes the need to introduce the, to actually employ the appropriate human resources to actually implement, and therein lies a challenge, not only for us, but I think to the broader energy sector as well. There's still a shortage of skills out in the marketplace, and one has to consider where those skills are going to come from, if it's going to support Sanedi or the broader energy sector out there. It doesn't really matter. The bottom line is there is a shortage of skills currently. On the energy efficiency mandate side, there is still a need for us to get clarification, particularly in line with our mandate from the National Energy Act, but I think also with respect to the expectations of both Parliament as well as stakeholders such as the Department of Energy. Now, in terms of the programs that are currently insufficiently or not funded at all, it's the Green Transport Program. We have had an undertaking from the Department of Transport, who are key to the success of this program. They have committed an allocation of 10 million rand per annum for the next 3 years, but they are still in discussions internally with respect to its allocation, so that has not materialized as yet. The Working for Energy program itself, its funding has come to an end. It received a 3-year allocation from Treasury. That has come to an end, I would suspect, pending the success of the projects that are currently being implemented. And then on the energy efficiency side, we have currently no funding for the programs that are set to be introduced. I think if one considers the effect that the funding allocation to ESCOM has had under MYPD3, we note that the allocation for energy efficiency and DSM has dropped quite dramatically from 13 billion to 5 billion over a 5-year period. With that comes obviously a bit of a clawback on the side of ESCOM with respect to reducing their support for energy efficiency and GSM. It is expected and has been discussed publicly before that Sanedi needs to take up the slack in that space. In order for us to do that, we do need a workable funding solution which either involves National Treasury or MYPD or even in fact a carbon tax to support the long-term implementation of energy efficiency. And we trust that the carbon framework under discussion at present, which includes a possible tax regime, that will make allowances for the implementation of energy efficiency as well. Bearing in mind, energy efficiency is also key under the climate change response flagship programs that have been housed inside of that policy. On the HR side, we have a staff complement of just over 40, of which most are professionals. From a representativity point of view, we are doing well, but from a technical skills perspective, obviously there's a lot more that has to be done. We are supporting an internship program that will allow for more and more technically qualified people to get exposure to our work environment. Unfortunately, any mentorship program will take time. We're operating a 1-year internship program. In that 1 year, they will get enough exposure to get employment somewhere else possibly, but at the same time, not necessarily enough to make an active contribution back into our program. So there is a small dilemma on our side, but we see it more as being our contribution into skills development and working closely with the CETAs in respect of internship. Now, our last few slides, Chair, are dedicated to the energy efficiency mandate, and one of the issues that concerns us is that there are a number of conflicting views between, first of all, the requirements of the Act, which are very specific and make reference to Sanedi's role in respect of implementing energy efficiency, but also, I think, given NERSA's own pronouncements recently regarding MYPD and the issues around whether ESCOM should be both a player and referee and should, in fact, be selling electricity rather than conserving electricity. Lastly, of course, there's the DOE's concerns about potential conflicts of interest, and that also relates to this player referee role. And it doesn't really matter as to whether it's ESCOM or Tuneni. The question still remains whether one entity would not pose a problem with respect to player referee conflicts. At the same time, the energy efficiency landscape is dominated by a number of players, which is possibly leading to inefficiency, particularly in the field of awareness raising, where you have a number of campaigns, and I've mentioned some of them to you before, but in particular they reference the 49M initiative, which is funded by ESCOM, ESCOM's own IDM, Integrated Demand Management Program. A lot of the local authorities are running their own awareness campaigns, and then of course the Power Alert feature, which runs on TV, which is supported by ESCOM as well. So along the way, you find that it's even now spreading to the research environment, where a number of entities are now undertaking R&D in the name of energy efficiency, and of course it can lead to dilution of efforts and wastage of public funds. Lastly, the average member of the public is becoming more and more confused. So many more choices are being made available to them, with different messages supporting each and every one. For instance, whether it's better to go for solar water heaters or go for heat pumps, whether it's better to go for CFLs, as we've been telling people in the past, or whether they should in fact replace even those CFLs with LED lighting. So there's a lot of confusion out there. We need to be very clear. There needs to be one repository of data and awareness raising so the members of the public know what choices they have and what to expect out of those choices once they've made them. So we need that central coordination repository at the end of the day, and we need to measure those impacts in real time. So what we're doing in the interim is that we're working together with the Department of Energy in producing a position paper. That position paper postulates a national clearinghouse facility that will ensure that there is proper integration, coordination, that there's also performance measurement and consolidated reporting, because it's becoming quite clear that we don't have an accurate figure for how much energy efficiency has in fact been introduced at any given time in the country. So we need that performance measurement system in place. We need to include some of the independent work that's been done under the tax incentive that I mentioned to you earlier, some of the demand-side management work from ESCOM, and some of the other activities that are led by the private sector themselves. This should all lead to the compilation and management of a central repository of energy efficiency data for the country, and then possibly extend this to cater for the channeling of donor funding, which is available to support energy efficiency to make sure that we avoid duplication at the end of the day. Along the way, we're also facilitating local international donor funding that is there in place to support energy efficiency by introducing variable costing models. You charge effectively only for what is relevant. So in fact, you're able to introduce efficiency in operations by implementing a variable costing model. At the same time, we can support resource optimization with our sister organizations, secondments and mutual skills development. I've mentioned Nexa, but also working together with NERSA. So there's really some synergy in how we're operating at present. This has also been extended to ESCOM and other members or other SOE members that we're currently working with. And then lastly, to be able to access skills development funding from the CETAs, the supports the use of interns, because we believe that those are critical. Give you an idea of how big the problem is. We went out last year on an ad looking for 10 interns, and we received well over 3,000 applicants for those 10 positions. So it gives you a sense of how many people are jobless out there, even though they are technically qualified and have a tertiary qualification. So there is a huge problem with respect to being able to employ our graduates in the country. And then just in conclusion, to focus on the funding allocation for this year, I think given all that I've mentioned before in terms of the programs, it's important that you have access to the right funding. We're happy to report that we have sufficient funding to undertake those activities. If one considers the baseline allocation from the DOE, it's gone up to $63 million for this year, which is up from $50 million last year. It does drop again to about $50 or $54 million in the next year, so there's still a need for us to increase the baseline allocation moving forward. Treasury has made available an initial sum of $2 million, which does go up, and this is to support a feasibility study into the use of shale gas in the country. And that really looks at the whole fracking issue and how we can best deal with the environmental fallout that is possible from fracking. CCS received 69 million for the pilot injection phase, which is scheduled for 2016-17. And then DSG's allocation is still at 6 million rand, which supports energy efficiency work, smart grids work, and the CCS space as well. And then lastly, the smart grid area received 71 million for the smart meter pilot, which is a combination of EU and DOE funding. And that will really support the introduction of the smart meter rollout. It's the first allocation of a three-year allocation in that respect. So on that note, Chair, on behalf of the team, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mamlons and Dr. Nasik. You've got a very, very interesting animal. Small, quiet, lean, and mean, but with very, very profound effects in its work. That's the deal that I can say for now, but I'll hand over to members for questions. Comment, Member Tureff.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Firstly, I'd like to comment about the institutional memory, which we lose so easily, because when the new ones come in, they want the old ones to go away, and they forget that they are losing, that's where we are losing our institutional memory. The other one is about it's about the storage. Is this storage, carbon storage underground, really going to be safe, or is it also going to bring now for us underground
contamination?
Yes, and also maybe to start getting what happened in Fukushima. And the other one which I just want to ask is the green transport. It's a good thing, but is it not going to be very expensive? And most people will not be able to afford to buy those cars. Then I just wanted to know about the ethanol jail. Does that mean that now we have stopped with the ethanol jail? Because I see the ethanol gel in Checkers shop, but I never saw anybody buying it. That's why it cannot move. Is it the reason? Thank you, sir.
Prof.
Thank you, sir. Let me start with this, another comment. How is the document was paged, so that I can refer you to page 3 for my question. I'm using this one, the small one. I couldn't read this one at all. It is too small for me. So I'm using this one. So sorry for that. I'm just going to, as I say, I'm using this big one. Let me go to the objectives generally. Or let me start with the page that deals with the financial support. There we have the 69 million, 102 million, and the 35 million. And we have the 25 million pounds. We have no figure for Norway and South Africa. is because we don't know there, we don't have now no idea about that. Let me go to your objectives, work plan. You have 14 work plan characters. Again, you are not giving a weapon to check you later. If I say, for example, creation of green jobs and contribution to the new growth path. I don't know about creating 2, 3, 15, 20. How can I call you to back to say, this is just a general now concerning your targets. Allow me to go to the book now. Let me take you to energy efficiency mandate clarification. There you are saying there are a number of conflicting views between those areas that you are referring to. I'm interested to know if you have any specific recommendations that you are putting on the table. Same thing with the efficiency, energy efficiency landscape. When you are saying there is that confusion, who is supposed to do what so that we don't have that confusion in the future? Okay, can I take you to this book now? I'm starting at page 29. Are you allowing me to ask all my questions? Was it too long?
Sure, go for it.
I'm taking you to page 29. That page 29 is raising something that I sense is important for you, which could possibly, on page 29, you are referring to let me go to page 34. I'm taking you to page 34. In page 34, in the very last paragraph on policy, environment, and governance structures, you are referring to something that I'm not, I think to me it seems to be important to you because you are repeating it. You are talking about innovation policy, such a specific provision under an energy technology innovation policy. You go to page 19, you refer to that policy again. You go to page 35, you refer to that policy again, which to me sounds like this is something very important. The question I'm having now, who is supposed to do what when in order for that policy so that we don't talk about it tomorrow? Is there any structure out there that needs to be coming by with that policy? I referred you to page 19, 34, and 35. Can I take you to page 37? In page 37, what confused me there are the years. In page 37, the paragraph below the bullets, can you see those bullets under program 1? It's starting with the operations of chapter 4. The last sentence there says, this process involves a key number of steps that will be progressed during the 2012-2013. Specific areas that are to be addressed include the following. It is as though you are looking in the future, but you are talking about 2012-2013. I don't know if it's me confused or there's something wrong there. Even if you go to the next paragraph, the paragraph under comprehensive compliance with existing legislation, Then if you go to the second paragraph, starting with the enabling legislation, we are saying there are specific issues that have to be addressed during the 2012-2013 year that have arisen from the transition. Again, I don't know whether you are looking forward or it's me confused. You have those 2012-2013 is a plan coming or is something that is maybe just clear on that. Let me take you to page 38. In page 38, it is the same year thing. Under B there, your second process, as the Navy requires a CFO to be put in place, it has appointed the acting CEO in the first quarter of 2012-13. Now the next sentence says, the position will be finalized in 2013 based on the budget availability. Do I take it to page 44? On page 44, Chair, we were dealing the paragraph. How do I refer to this paragraph? It starts with one of the sub-programs housed within program 2 is the development of technologies for the use of alternative fuels to be used in government fleet and public transport. That interested me now. That there is something that is going to be used for those public fleets. The question that arose to me, whether I was interested in that, was to when is this envisaged to take place? Because to me, it sounds like something good that is coming. Do I take you my last question, Chair, on page 48, the next page, 45, in your figures there, your table, on page 45. Let me take the green energy solutions, for example. For clean energy solutions, I got a sense we are saying the external alternative, there is nothing there, budget required. You don't require anything, but you are given something. And that, to me, doesn't mean what they say. Go to the next one. It says the budget required for smart grids. You don't need any. It is because it is outside. I cannot even say it is externally funded because, but you say you are given 11 million. Did they give that by mistake because you didn't need it? You can go to the next one again, the one that deals with. Let's go to the. No. Maybe this is just a general statement there to how do those figures comments work. Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, tell them not.
Two quick questions. One is around the Department of Energy has allocated 548 million. For energy efficient lighting to municipalities. I just want to establish from SANEF whether they interacted with the Department of Energy around the specifications for this lighting and whether they would be very helpful in terms of energy efficiency, our campaign on energy efficiency. The second question, Jefferson, just a small one. It's given that you have been given a mandate by DOE and initial allocation on fracking. I just want to understand from you whether you are interacting with the another state-owned enterprise called PetroSA, because PetroSA would be also be involved. Is there any coordination and synergy between the two organizations? I understand yours might be more on research and development, but the other side would be more interested in commercialization. So is there any interaction and feedback between the two institutions?
Just a few from my side as well. You know, just generally, under our mission, you make reference to transition towards a sustainable low carbon energy in future. I know the National Development Commission at some stage did even arrange a couple of workshops on that one. Of course, the NDP captures it. It's just a matter of interest to see how much role have you been playing, or will you still be playing in that sphere, the transition, because it's quite an intricate area. You may have referred to it, but it's maybe a combination of your previous and your future role. Actually, you threw my attention on the use of biogas digesters. It's a very interesting technology, that one. Just a comment, to what extent could this be viable for rural schools? Having been to a semi-rural school once upon my life. Could be an interesting, you know, thing. You made reference on the smart grids, of coupling the smart grids drive with e-learning. Can you elaborate a little bit on that one? With regards to work for energy program and the use of energy efficiency, I would like the Department of Energy to comment on that. And also the amongst the challenges, the one of conflict of interest. If the Department of Energy can comment on that, it could be very helpful. And on the solar water heater versus heat pumps, the area around the confusion within the public market, I think Mr. Berry could be helpful just to remind. I know we shared some activity recently at the Domestic Use Energy Conference. There was a couple of things that were raised there. Mr. Brett McGovern, if you could just rekindle that for the benefit of the members. And on that area as well, one of the areas of interest is that do you have any engagement with the what do you call them, energy service companies? Yeah, ESCOs and the association, because actually what I'm saying was triggered by one of the, you know, ESCOs presentations. It's a very, very interesting area. Okay, that's all for now.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can just proceed to answering some of those questions in the order that I picked them up. First of all, I think on the issue around institutional memory, it's a problem that has affected the entire country. And if one considers ESCOM, between 15 and 12 years ago, ESCOM instituted their own knowledge management system, which uses a tool called Hyperwave, which is a very good tool, but it involves actually sitting down and being able to actually map out how does a power station work. What research has been done on each facet of a power station, and because the power station is so large, they had to zoom in on, let's just say, the chemistry of a power station as an example. So they started off with that, and then they said, what is the history of the work that's been done on the chemistry of, so all the boiler feed water, actually all the condensate water, all the
everything, the use of gas inside of the power station, that's besides the chemistry of coal. All of that work has been mapped out, and it's a systematic process, and it takes a very long time, but it's necessary, and unfortunately that's the key with knowledge management. It takes time, but you can do it. Even within the department, by virtue of an example, when I was in the department, which is, let's just say, about 2005, we prepared a blueprint for the rollout of a feed-in tariff for renewable energy, and that was with the support of the Danish government. So we produced the whole outline of the feed-in tariff, only for NERSA a couple of years later to produce its own tariff outline, which is slightly different, but in essence almost the same thing. So it just gives you a sense that in the space of about, say, 2 to 3 years, we had an entirely new framework being developed under the auspices of a single department. So it does happen. So the key really is to have a dedicated resource inside of an entity that puts in place the right tools and then knows how to go and capture what we call the tacit or explicit knowledge that is available to the organization. So, yeah, you're right. It is a big challenge, and this is why for the energy sector, we've now lost critical people that have been involved in capturing data, for instance, things like coal end use. Not many people are familiar with the fact that you could just drive up to a coal mine and collect coal and pay by the ton, and that's it. We don't know what happens to that coal. So a lot of data, in fact, is aligned to that knowledge management, and it has to be captured. Your second question regarding CCS and the storage of CO2 underground, this is where stakeholder engagement is key, because we need to sensitize the public as to how CO2 storage actually takes place. First of all, at the depths that we're talking about, which can be anything from 3 to 5 kilometers down, the actual CO2 is under so much pressure that it actually liquefies and it blends into the substrate below it. Now, we look at two factors, porosity and permeability, to determine how far will the CO2 actually spread once it's underground. And you do regular tests. So, for instance, we have seen from the first commercial CO2 storage facility, which is in Norway, Sleipner, we can actually see over a period of 10 years what's happened seismically, and we can see how far the CO2 spreads. And over time, what happens to it, it actually merges with the rock to form what we call a mineral carbonate. So that's the chemistry of how CO2 actually becomes part of the substrate itself. So that, and of course, the mineral carbonate is benign. At the depth that you're talking about, it's very difficult for the CO2 to come back up because, as I said to you, it's become liquefied at those depths. And this is why we even, at one stage, we're looking at perhaps abandoned mines, even though there's a risk of actually sterilizing mine resources that are still left down below, because you have to trap off, you have to seal off the cavities in which you store the CO2. So this is why, even though there's large storage potential, we need to be very clear that the CO2 will never escape, and this is why you need the right geological studies to be done, and that looks at the seismic activity as well. You cannot operate in an area where you have unusual or high seismic activity. You have to make sure that those areas are going to be sound in terms of the integrity for the next 100, 200 years that the CO2 is stored down there. And just to move on to some of the other questions that were raised on the green transport issue. It depends on what type of solution you're introducing. That will determine how cost effective it is. The examples that I usually use are the one of the taxi industry, where we convert them to run on LPG. Bearing in mind, you're introducing a hybrid solution, so they don't run on LPG alone. It's a combination of LPG and petrol, and all petrol. And given the cost, and the cost is about 18 to 20,000 rand, it just depends on the individual system that you implement, and the payback is about a year. So for the taxi industry, it was a win-win situation all around. So it was cheaper for them to run their fleet than on petrol only, and they obviously got the payback in a relatively short period of time. Other areas, CNG, almost as cheap, but bearing in mind the access to gas. That is more of a limiting factor. Even for LPG, you need a special refueling plant, so that you'll have another dispenser at your existing service station. You would have another pump that would be dedicated to LPG. For CNG, it's a little bit more trickier. So you need access to the right refueling infrastructure, which might make the cost slightly higher. For electric vehicle technology, the challenge will always be with batteries. You need a lot of batteries to be able to get a range out of an electric vehicle. A typical battery pack, which is normally lithium ion these days, will get you up to 200 kilometer range. So even the Nissan Leaf, which is one of the latest electric vehicles, will get you about 200 kilometers. that's not bad. If you consider normal town driving, you don't do 200 kilometers per day, and you charge, again, recharge at night. Obviously, if you want to go down to the coast, you're going to have to use an alternative, which is why the LPG, hybrid, or whatever is a better solution in any case. The cost of batteries is high. This is why some companies look at leasing batteries, and then you can replace those batteries once they reach the end of their useful life. For us, one of the important things to consider is instead of buying an electric vehicle, which is relatively expensive, is to perhaps consider the aspect around retrofits, being able to convert your old vehicle to an electric vehicle. And to do that, you're going to have to spend money, yes, but if we consider, and this is the point that I raised yesterday in other discussion, was that we don't have a scrapping age for our vehicles. If we had a mandatory scrapping age, it would be easier for us to motivate and encourage the public to shift to alternative forms of transportation if they were going to pay a penalty in terms of the continued use of their vehicle. So even a CO2 tax, if applied to vehicles, would have an impact in terms of motivating the public to switch. It could also have preferential parking, et cetera, preferential park, not only parking rates, but preferential parking and access routes for electric vehicles, and this makes it so much easier to get the public to shift. But at the very least, you need to start off with LPG and CNG, and then even biofuels. Now, the market for biofuels is there. Unfortunately, the feedstock is not necessarily always there. So that's become one of the biggest challenges, getting our feedstock for biofuels together. So we are restricted in terms of what we can use for bioethanol and biodiesel, and we're probably going to need more incentives if we're going to introduce biodiesel on a large enough scale to make a difference in as far as its consumption is concerned. Ethanol gel doesn't work for a number of reasons. First of all, the lack of appropriate standards in the past. What would happen is that to produce ethanol gel, they would blend it with water. Of course, as you know, you can't burn water. You can't produce energy from it. So the reality is that in order to sell more gel, they would blend the gel with water. And so you end up with a very inefficient product that could not compete with paraffin. And given that paraffin is so much more widely distributed than ethanol gel would ever be, and you require a different burner head on your stove to use the gel, it does limit the use of ethanol gel. So in all respects, ethanol gel will stay there as an alternative fuel for camping, for, you know, whatever other application you may want, but it's not necessarily set in the short term to be a mainstream alternative to paraffin. The opposite.
Is it cleaner?
Gee, absolutely cleaner. You could actually eat ethanol gel. I wouldn't advocate you eat it, but you could. The worst thing you're going to get is a stomachache.
And the R&D work on it right now?
No, not from our side, Chair. There is a stove cooking research facility at the University of Johannesburg, and they are looking at alternative stoves, burners, etc. like that, but not at the fuel, not as far as I'm familiar with the fuel itself. As I said to you, the fuel, if you have the right standard of fuel, it is as efficient, almost as efficient as paraffin. But then the cost factor will come into play because you have to consider your source of ethanol. If you consider that you're not drinking the ethanol, that the ethanol is being used as a fuel, then we should be subjected to less taxation, import duties, etc. for ethanol. So there's a whole industry around it that has to be developed further, Chair. But that's currently one of the limiting factors as well, is the access to ethanol. But yes, I mean, we've had experiments where people have actually eaten the gel just to show that the gel is actually edible. And then
we take note that we are strongly not recommending that.
I'm strongly discouraging anyone try it. But absolutely, but it was important, Chair. This is why, in fact, you're safe, and so pretty safe isn't, well, there are some representatives of SEP here. But one of the projects that was undertaken at SEP was actually to gel paraffin, which is a very worthwhile exercise. Because you think of all the children ingest paraffin, this is a very worthwhile initiative. Unfortunately, once again, it came down to a cost issue. Being able to produce this waxy solid disc that you could actually then burn, it was pure paraffin. But unfortunately, once again, there's the cost implication of doing that. And then the Paraffin Safety Association, while it was still around, and unfortunately they closed their doors, they saw it more fit to rather look at tamper-proof containers as the way forward for paraffin rather than looking at actually doing something with the fuel itself. But think of fire spreading. You won't have that risk in terms of some of the informal settlements, because now the fire wouldn't spread that easily once you've got this disc, which is made from paraffin itself. So yes, it's a small cost increment, but compare that to the cost of a life, compare that to your livelihood, and it starts to pay in comparison.
Right. The industry
industry contribution, that's for CCS. We can give you those figures accurately. Our CFO, Raquel, has got those figures handy. Industry and the Norwegian government. Well, it's an allocation from the Norwegian government of about 1 million rand per year. And I think industry's contribution is probably about 6 or 7 million.
Yes, Jay. We have the industry contributions is from Sasol, Norway, as CEO has said. Then also we have various partners, Eskom. Eskom contributes as well as PetroSA, Anglo America, and Xstrata. So that's all the donors, and it amounts to about 6.9 per annum.
That's the industry contribution as well. Then on the issue around creating green jobs, and in fact in our strategic documents we do make reference to the strategic objectives where we actually do have the KPIs that go up against each one, and they talk about the specific jobs that will be created. The number one target that we set ourselves in terms of measurement is what we call the carbon intensity of the economy, because we try to unify a lot of diverse areas. And bearing in mind what we said earlier, our number one objective is to support a transition to a low carbon future. And the only way to measure that realistically is to look at the carbon intensity of the economy. So the strategic document, strategic plan, talks to that indicator and then says how we calculate it, and then we can try and reference each and every project back to that particular indicator. But along the way, for instance, for Working for Energy, we have specific jobs that are attributed to the Working for Energy program. So those are included in the document. The issue around the technology innovation policy is an interesting one, because it's something that we've been suggesting for some time is required in the country. And the question is, who develops that policy? And it should be between the Departments of Energy and the Department of Science and Technology. And even though there is an innovation strategy which the department is looking at as science and technology, one of the critical things that are not being considered is, what is South Africa looking for out of an innovation framework? And the reason why we ask that question is that if you consider the pebble bed modular reactor as an example, what does South Africa want to be in that space? Do you want to be a market leader? Do you want to be an adopter of technology? Or do you want to be a fast follower? So you're almost the first to the market after the technology has been developed. South Africa needs to define its role in relation to that space, because understanding that it may take you hundreds, tens of millions of rands to develop the concept around PBMR, but it will take you billions and in some cases trillions of rands to get you to a commercial product that you could then sell under license internationally. We have to then decide, is that how much we're willing to risk and invest in that space? And the same argument applies to the optimal energy jewel. We were happy to spend as a country tens of millions of rands to get the first prototypes up and running, and we produced about 8 of these vehicles. But at the time that it required an investment, we didn't go as far as to provide that necessary support, because once we reached the point where we had to go into commercial production, we now started looking at hundreds of millions of rands and even up into a billion rand to be able to make this thing a reality. Now, before you invest the tens of millions of rands, be clear this is where you want to go, because that's the reality that you're facing, and that's the basis behind this innovation policy, that it should spell out where does South Africa want to play in the energy space, and it should be clear. For instance, cell phone technology, one of the former science and technology ministers wanted to know how come South Africa has so many cell phones but we don't have one local cell phone. And the answer is simple: we cannot churn out a cell phone faster than Korea or the United States or any of the other bigger players. Even the Finnish can produce them, so there's no point. As soon as you produce a product, a competitor will come up with something 10 times cheaper in the space of 1 year. So you cannot compete. So you accept that you will just be an adopter of technology in the cell phone industry, unfortunately. So that's the thing that's required in the energy space to proceed. With respect to dates, activities that commenced in 2012-13, this is a rolling 5-year plan in essence for the strategic plan. And even though our focus is the 13-14 year onwards, there are activities that started in 12-13 that have to continue into this 5-year plan. This is why they are referenced as such. Perhaps the way they've been reflected is perhaps slightly misleading. But for instance, activities around the CFO appointment. So the acting CFO, for instance, was appointed in 2012-13, but during the course of the calendar year 2013, the appointment of the CFO, the final appointment will be done during the course of the calendar year 2013. So it's probably just the way that it's been slightly misleading. We're also excited about the issue around the green transport aspect, and I've already alluded earlier to some of the areas where you can make a difference. One of the big things you need is refueling infrastructure. There's no question about that. There are market players that are sitting out there waiting to introduce their LPG technology and their CNG technology, but they need refueling infrastructure. The same for electric vehicle manufacturers. They want to make sure that we have put in place charging facilities, that there is research into new battery technology, and this is part and parcel of what CNED is focused on at this stage. I think the budget line items that were referenced earlier, there are gaps in there because they don't reference all the budgets as far as I can tell. I'm just looking at it again. For instance, the smart grids doesn't have anything because we have an internal baseline allocation, which is one single figure, and part of those funds are then used to support some of the smart grids work, but not directly. They all form part of the baseline allocation. Where there are explicit numbers, you'll see on that page, I think it was 45, you will see, for instance, the smart meter implementation one, which is the EU South Africa one. That has got the 71 million, and it's actually got a further allocation over the five-year period. I think it's about 171. It's about that amount. So that figure is the external one, which is then supporting the smart meter one. But the smart grid program itself isn't funded explicitly on its own. It's got an output, which is the smart meter one. It's the same for the clean energy space. It does not have an output. It is a holding program. It has sub-activities under them, for instance, the record center, the WASA project, and so on, and they have their own allocations that are referenced separately. On the issue around the public lighting issue, I think Barry, do you want to just maybe talk about that one, and then also the landscape confusion? I think that question came up as well, about how we are, either what is the possible solution to this confusion in the energy efficiency landscape?
Thank you, and Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. It's a very interesting point, and it came up at the Department of Trade and Industry about the public lighting now. The money is channeled from National Treasury through the distribution of revenue at DORA through the Department of Energy to various municipalities who submit business plans to upgrade, in essence, traffic lights and public lights or street lights, as we know. There is problems in that the municipalities, as a local government organization, they have their own tender procedures, and they usually go out on a specific tenders for a year or 2 years, 3 years for specific suppliers, so that when they need emergency stock, this is available. So it's very difficult to enforce specific specifications. The requirement is that it has to be energy saving, not necessarily a particular specification, which that then allows the municipalities to do a variety of things, which not necessarily is the most efficient solution. So what DTI called the meeting this week, and what they're looking at is creating, and the Department of Energy was there, we were there, and we've now created a task team to look at the designation of energy efficient lighting in South Africa, where, similar to the solar water heating program, there'll be specific requirements, and that will include local content as well, because right now some of the technologies are imported, some of them aren't, some of them are partly assembled in South Africa. It's just a nightmare, and if you drive in any three different cities, you'll see three different street lights. You'll see yellow lights, you'll see white lights, you'll see some overhanging the road, you'll see some straight up. It's not standardized, and there's valid reasons for that, but there is a plan in place now to try and work towards a common understanding and to actually make sure that, like the Solar Water Heating Million Program, that South Africa benefits as well as the users of the particular roads. So that is in place. In terms of the confusion. The Honourable Chair mentioned we were at the Domestic Use of Energy Conference now just very recently, and there was a very good presentation by one of the chaps there on water heating specifically, and not only looking at water heating as opposed to solar water heating as opposed to heat pump. He was looking just within the solar water heating space. If you as a resident decide you want to make the step and you want to buy a solar water heater, what do you do? You'll go to the Eskom website and you'll see over 300 suppliers of solar water heaters on the website. How do you make an informed choice? You might want to contact an ESCO and you'll see over 200 ESCOs registered on the Eskom website. There's no real advice except to say use a solar water heater. So you could be using the wrong technology for the wrong geographical area you're staying in. You might need a specific evacuated tube on the coast because you don't have hail there, and you might not want to put that in the high veld because of hail and you might have problems. So there is, the technologies are there, the intention is there, but in terms of how we inform people, we take it for granted. We work with these things every day. So we say, use the solar water, do we take it for granted? People will be able to use the solar water. It's not that easy. And we have to come with more streamlined and informative campaigns. The confusion is that you as a resident could drive home tonight and see a billboard which says 49M tells you to switch off, and a plug and a lady's hand, and it says switches off. You get home, you see power alert, and it says switch off your swimming pool pump and non-essential appliances. You put on the radio and you'll hear the city of Cape Town is now advocating you must do something specific. Everyone with good intentions, because we do have an energy crisis in the country and everyone wants to play their part. But we're not taking into consideration the resident who's getting bombarded with all these different messages. And they sit back, like the solar water industry, and say, what do I do? So they just leave it. And they don't do anything because it's confusing. So the further question was, what are we proposing? We're preparing this positioning statement that there's some streamlining in terms of who does what, and we're looking at best practices in two of the BRICS countries, and we're also looking at two of the more advanced in terms of energy efficiency countries, like Germany, for example, and Spain, and looking how they're doing, how they're getting this message across in a consistent way, and that it's getting the biggest bang for their buck. What, in essence, in the awareness creation now, what is in the position paper is that we're recommending the establishment of a very simple web-based database. So everyone who's doing awareness and advertising should have access to this. And everyone should put their plans on that particular website. So if Eskom wants to do something on solar water heating today, they can go to the website and say, well, Cape Town's just running a big campaign on heat pumps. Don't do it. Rather talk to each other and try and come find common ground. That we can, at the end of the day, have every month a good campaign with a different technology, because in summer certain things are very important to save energies, which are not applicable, like for example swimming pool pumps, which are not necessarily applicable in winter. Solar water heating in different regions has different requirements. So that there's a platform that everyone can access and make sure that every month we have a theme with a technology. The money that's being spent is being duplicated. There's advertising and awareness creation on television and billboards and that is very, very expensive. It consumes a lot of money. And we're all using the same money at the same time. Instead of using that money in a pool and spreading it over a year and getting a consistent message. So the position paper will be ready within the next month, which will then obviously be discussed with the department, and they're very involved in the process, and will come back here to try and find a way that we can optimize. As I said in the beginning, everyone's got very good intentions, but it is actually now becoming an inefficient situation. The water heating specifically, we have to come up with solutions on that, because right now people are confused, and it came out in the presentation. What decision do I make? And if I'm considering either or, who do I phone? Do I phone Eskom? Do I phone my local municipality? And the municipality call centers are getting hundreds of calls. They say, no, phone Eskom. They told you to do this. We just handle power failures. They phone us, hundreds of calls. Who do you phone? Where do you get the best advice? And you need that central repository that can actually assist people in making these decisions. So we are working on that and working with all the role players, not to step on toes, because at the end of the day, SENEDI doesn't have a vested interest. We don't build power stations. We're not under pressure to build new power stations to generate megawatts. We're doing it as public good. We believe that the public needs to do this, not only for saving Eskom's behind, but there are other socio-economic reasons why we should be doing it. The tariff increase impact, the jobs that can be created, and all these other things we have to report on, not just on we save 30 megawatts, because that is what's important for Eskom, but there are other things that are more important for other government line functions and for society, the broader society as a whole. And the one area that really plays a big role is on the previously disadvantaged areas. These are the people that need to have energy efficiency the most. They can least afford to pay their electricity bill. The person saying Sandton can afford to pay his bill. He's getting the rebates, he's getting the advice, he's getting all the information in the right appropriate languages, but he can afford to pay his bill. A person sitting in a very rural town might get a free solar water, which is a low pressure system. What do you do in that case? Because right now you're giving a low pressure solar water heating system, but the price of water is going up. Now that person might not necessarily have used a lot of water in the past. Now you're saying free energy from the sun, and the person gets a solar water heater for free. And now people end up showering for longer and the water bill goes up. But we work with energy, so we don't think about the water impact. We have to address that in the lower end of the market. And that is a completely different channel to putting a power alert saying switch off your lights and your appliances. I mean, that's not happening right now. So, Chair and Honourable Members, we as an EDI are aiming to play a facilitation role there to assist the department and all the other line functions to get the biggest bang for our buck. Thank you.
If I may proceed, we'll have to come back to, I think, Barry, just maybe, do you want to explain the solar water heating heat pump issue and our role with the ESCOs in more detail later? I'll come back.
A bit faster, we've run out of time.
Thanks, Chair. I'll run very quickly through this, Chair. We will be working with Petros on the fracking issue. Certainly, our interests are not commercial, but this is why we need to work with the other state entities that have a commercial interest in this. We have worked on the National Development Plan. In fact, we were the contributors, part of the contributors from the energy sector, as we were contributors to the climate change response strategy as well. Biogas digesters, I was going to ask Mr. Mauma to add to this, but I think in the interest of time, I'll just mention quickly that this is one of our focal areas. In fact, there have been other projects that have been undertaken in the past, in particular from UKZN, where they've actually been working in rural schools in KZN and setting up digesters. Obviously, there's a maintenance issue. There's a utilization issue which goes into the use of biogas digesters at schools, but it all comes down to awareness, but it does have a role to play. The question is what you use the gas for. Some people are averse to the idea of using a gas derived from human waste, so one has to be very clear as to what you're going to use the gas for. In the case of a rural school, it wouldn't necessarily be advisable to use it for cooking unless you have proper scrubbers built into it, so you'd have to use it for something else, whether it be space heating, lighting, or something else, Chair. So just keep that aspect in mind.
I remember it's just an interesting thing because sometimes the ease of access in those areas, and even lowering costs, I mean, waste just gets readily available and you know, it can be used. And I trust as we move along in handling that area, I hear you talking about skill, but I thought that's where FETs would come in.
We are intending to work with the CETAs on that. We've already started our projects, in particular the ones in the Western Cape and Eastern Cape, where we are training up locals in the construction of biogas digesters. But to continue that, to replicate it and scale it up, we are going to need the support of the CETAs moving forward. But just to establish a framework for doing it, I think that's been our focus up until now. On the smart grid side, you asked me just to explain the linkage to e-learning. One of the things that happens is when you have a smart meter, you need an interface that allows you to look at the smart meter and understand what it is that your actual meter is metering and to understand how to influence your consumption as well. To do that, you need some form of, let's say, tablet. You need some form of device like an iPad, which is at the higher end of the market, or we need, in fact, a low-income solution. This is what we've been advocating, is that an entity like TIER supports the market in developing a solution for South Africa which is a lower tech but yet still functional tablet that you can use in the household to interface with your smart meter and actually appreciate what it is that the smart meter is doing. But at the same time, we can actually let our learners in these areas, particularly rural, low-income areas, have access to these devices so that we can actually load up all their textbooks onto these devices. And actually also allow in the areas where we can, if we have Wi-Fi enabled areas, to be able to actually have web-based classes running so that teachers in Bryanston could be giving lectures and classes to learners in Polokwane, for instance. This is the type of thing that you'd want to actually put in place. So this is the thrust of the e-learning interface with smart metering, and we're hoping to pilot that concept in the course of the year if we get the necessary backing from the Department of Basic Education, Chair. Then on to working for energy. I think the question was more on the energy efficiency side, but I think it related to the Department of Energy and their views. Okay, so I'll leave that for the department. And then I don't know, Chief, we can just conclude with Barry again on the issues around the solar water heating issues, heat pumps, and the ESCOs. Quickly.
Thank you. Thanks once again, Chair. On the solar water issue, we now assisting the national regulator for compulsory standards at the SABS to assist on heat pumps, the comparison between heat pumps and solar water heater, and to determine the actual losses. We've made a lot of regulations. We've made huge strides in testing solar water heaters, but when it comes to labeling them now in terms of the energy efficiency label, we've realized that we don't know what the actual losses are, the heat losses on solar water heaters in South Africa. So they're busy drafting the terms of reference that we've offered as an area through the Energy Efficiency Hub to assist in doing the actual research that the labeling can take place in the same vein on heat pumps and solar water heaters. So you'll be able to make a decision, maybe an A-rated solar water heater or a B-rated heat pump. So we're working on that particular area. As far as the ESCOs are concerned, we work very closely with the ESCO Association. We ex officio members of the organization and the association, and we assist them in a number of areas. The biggest problem, and it came out in their presentation on the revised strategy, is that we have these 300 ESCOs registered, but the training, the capacity building, the skills of these people, a lot of them are one-man bands that can change light bulbs. They're not a real energy service company. Energy service company should be able to do the full spectrum from insulation to air conditioning to heating to cooling to water heating. So the biggest problem is training, and through our hub and another initiative that we're doing, we're trying to create an incubator to bring all the training. There's lots of training available. I'm not saying there's no training. But these courses start at 7,000 Rand and they go up to 10,000 Rand. So if you're trying to stimulate SMME development, that just eliminates the biggest target market straight away. So we're trying to develop a curriculum and working with the CEDIS to develop those training courses that these ESCOs that are registered can actually be true ESCOs in the sense of the word, or in the sense of the definition, which is internationally accepted. And we are working with them very closely. Thank you, Chair.
Memo Khat.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Thanks, the colleagues in Sanedi. I will start with a question in terms of the innovation policy, just to add to what has already been alluded to before I get to the other questions. I just need to confirm that there is an MOU that is already being worked on between the Department of Energy and Science and Technology, including the work that would be executed within the state-owned entities. So the deadline to complete the MOU is June. I hope in the next reporting session we will be sharing the information relating to exactly what is in the MOU, but I can confirm that it touches on various sectors within the energy sector in relation to the innovation and research aspects. It includes nuclear, clean energy, smart grid, like a whole lot of, just to name a few. And on the issue of the lighting in municipalities, I think Barry has already covered the issue around procurement. When the transfers are made, even though we sign contracts with municipalities, it's at the high level. We don't give specifications in terms of the actual projects that have to be procured. So that is within the sphere of the municipalities. What is in the contract is confirmation in terms of the energy savings, which we kind of press it when it comes to the reporting relating to the MNV report, which constitutes the annual performance in terms of energy saved that is also submitted to Department of, National Treasury. There is the discussion as well to add on what has been discussed on the confusion relating to the energy efficiency product. I hope the members would recall that on Tuesday, when the Department of Energy reported on their strat plan and the programs that we are dealing with, we did indicate that the current model that we're using on energy efficiency, particularly the geysers, we are getting into a new contracting model where Eskom is expected to contract with manufacturers. And like on that, we don't have more than 10 manufacturers, there are more or less 7. And in that case, the issue of dealing with inefficient products or confusion around which product to choose, it's also confined within that contracting model, in also making sure that we deal with issues of localization. Once we localize, we are able to promote our own proudly South African products, which we know that they're addressing our conditions. Two, with relation to the energy efficiency campaign, you would recall that in 2008, GCIS was appointed as the energy efficiency campaign leader within the country until 2011. They handed over the report, which specifically indicated some of the recommendations that need to be tackled further in dealing with energy efficiency campaign within the country. Within those recommendations, one which was executed with immediate effect was to develop the National Energy Efficiency Strategy, which was taken through the NEDLAC process, and it was signed off at that level. Maybe to say unfortunate is the financial resources were not enough in terms of robustly executing that strategy. But I must say the discussions in relation to how do we get the allocated funds from like each one of us into one pot, that has been a challenge in terms of making sure that we have like all the financial resources by different institutions in one pot and conveying the same message. But the discussions are continuing in terms of making sure that we convey the message from the common understanding. Can I request that the question on working for energy be repeated so that I answer appropriately?
I think with regards to the to working for energy program, what one was interested much is from the department's perspective, you know, how much benefit do we see out of that, and what's your intentions to ensure that that program, you know, is sustained? Because yeah, that's exactly what I wanted, because the funds are drying. Are there any ways of ensuring that that program is sustained? Have you applied your minds on that?
I just need to indicate that maybe we need to reflect backward in terms of when the Working for Energy program started. We have been in discussions with National Treasury in terms of getting the program recurring. But like one of the challenges for the program was to prove in terms of the job created within the program itself. And like the door for discussion is still open once we have a convincing case to National Treasury to make sure that this program continues. Two, there was a clear recommendation that all of us, the DOE, together with SANEDI, we are dealing with in terms of integrating the program within the public works extension program. That program automatically, once you start proving the job created, you get credits in terms of funding. So that those are the issues that we are dealing with. And I would request Mahuma to add to this discussion, because he has been part of the team that has been working on how to make sure that the program is clearly integrated within the Working for Energy program, not only with Public Works, but with Department of Environmental Affairs as well.
I'm just uneasy, one of members. We've run out of time. Yeah, it's not a big issue. Can we conclude, man?
Can you conclude? Let us thank Mamlouz and Dr. Nassif and your team for your illustrative and instructive input. But once again, honourable members, just something was striking. You know, if you look at the vision statement of SANET, it says to serve as a catalyst. That's very striking because usually entities serve as delivery entities. They have got to deliver something. But this one, primarily, it sees itself as working as a catalyst. I think along our journey, doing oversight work on you, we would really see how we unpack that one and how we get really a common understanding, working as a catalyst, which was, to me, the implication is that you integrate or work a lot with a whole host of other players. You know, at times it may even get submerged with work with other players. Other members, I'm sure, in terms of the working for energy program and energy efficiency, whenever you have a chance, it might be a good thing for some extra oversight visit so that we can see what exactly is being done there. You know, Mamu Khadi, you struck a chord when you say credits due to job creation, so it might be quite a lovely thing for us to see, you know, how that is panning out. I think on that score, we would be glad if we could get this GCIS report, maybe the committee secretary, on energy efficiency. Because once again, there is some indication of discoordination and lack of and fragmentation, to be blunt, in the energy efficiency sphere. And hopefully the discussion paper that's going to come from SANET will help on that. And Mamu Khadi, once it goes through the department, surely it would be lovely if you could come and share it with us here with the committee. And on that note, can we have the meeting adjourned? Thanks, everyone, for the stamina of staying up until now. We'll be meeting next week to listen to the big guns, NERSA, the regulator, on the 23rd at 9 o'clock. At Committee Room 1, 90 Plain Street. Thank you very much for today. Thank you.